Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, and to paraphrase the advertising slogan, there is no substitute. Tonight, we are coming at you, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of dark energy. You've arrived at a nexus point, a crossroads of shadow and light, a phantasmagorical marketplace of ideas and blasphemies where together we prowl through the wilderness of smoke and mirrors in the collective psyche, maybe with the unyielding inquisitiveness of a Vulcan mind meld. We are Coast to Coast AM, a grand melting pot of cultures and subcultures from the benign to the bizarre, all on the same path, searching for breadcrumbs of cosmic understanding and hoping we'll be able to follow the trail back to where we started. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, ramrod of tonight's cacophony of conversation, and I am very glad to be back with you once again. Where were you exactly 20 years ago tonight? Do you know exactly where you were and what you were doing on March 22, 1989? If you do, then it must be your wedding anniversary, or maybe the night one of your kids was born. Most of us could only guess what we were doing 20 years ago on this very night. My guests for tonight's show can answer the question in great detail. They know exactly where they were and what they were doing. They were out in the Nevada desert, in the darkness, a small band of merry pranksters drawn to a then-obscure spot on the outskirts of an unknown military base the world now knows as Area 51, drawn there by a man they knew who said he worked inside and who told them there would be a test flight of something, something remarkable. They waited in the cool desert air, hoping to avoid any unpleasant encounters with heavily armed security patrols, and then they saw it, right where they'd been told it would be, rising up above the hills abutting Papoose Dry Lake. It was saucer-shaped, as far as they could tell, and it was glowing, generating an intense light, intense even though it was miles away. What happened that night was the first pebble in an avalanche, the first part of a chain reaction that continues to emanate to this day. Group members came back on the same night the next 2 weeks. They saw the same thing being test-flown over Papoose Lake. They watched it, they videotaped it, and then they were caught by the security guys, and the person who had led them out there was in big trouble. But even so, by then, it was too late. This cat was about to emerge from the bag, and the world was about to be changed. That unknown base would become a household name, an iconic symbol of secrecy and myth, a focal point for our conspiratorial worries and fantasies, and a superstar of sorts, Area 51, flying saucers, alien technology, and the legend of Bob Lazar. It all began 20 years ago tonight and is still unfolding today. And we're going to hear about it, how this whole thing started, by talking with two of the men who were there from the very beginning. Aviator John Lear, who's been my guest on this program a number of times, and Gene Huff, a Las Vegas real estate appraiser and budding screenwriter. They both made those trips out into the desert, both saw the craft, both knew Bob Lazar during the time that he said he worked out there, and together they know more about how this story began and unfolded than anyone. I'm confident you're going to enjoy this conversation. We're also hoping to hear from a mystery guest tonight, not too hard to figure out who that might be. We are hoping that Bob Lazar joins us sometime during this program. Can't say for sure. Bob has been moving his business and his animals from New Mexico to the Midwest, driving all that way with quite a little caravan, I guess. And so I know his butt is dragging this weekend, but we've invited him to chime in, sort of to dish out some on-air grief to his friends and maybe to his critics. And whether he does or not, though, we're going to be joined by John Lear and Gene Huff coming up toward the bottom of this hour, 15, 20 minutes or so from now, and it's going to be fun. Also there, an article about the discovery of salty liquid water on Mars. Now, this news was kind of quietly released in the past week or so. We now have solid evidence that what was spotted forming on the leg of one of the Mars landers are droplets of this salty water, liquid water, obviously an essential ingredient for life. And this is, in my view, pretty big news. First time they've had confirmation of this. I mean, they've had plenty of hints previously, but now it is a generally accepted fact that there's water on Mars. And why it wasn't a bigger news story is beyond me, but you can read about it on the COAST site. One other thing I think you'll want to see there, it's an amazing set of photos from World War II, taken in Burbank, California, the home of the Lockheed Skunk Works, where they build some of the best airplanes in the world, including, in later years after the war, the U-2 and the SR-71. Anyway, they wanted to disguise the plant so that if any enemy bombers flew over, it would look like from the air like some sort of harmless farmland, not worth bombing. And they pulled it off, as you'll see in these photos. They covered the whole thing, the whole plant, all of its facilities with these camouflage tarps. And darned if it didn't look like farmland, at least from the sky, the photos you'll see there. The reason this is relevant for us today is because it dovetails into the Area 51 story, the one told by Bob Lazar. As you might remember, those of you who are familiar with the story, Lazar had said that he worked at a facility called S4, which was next to the Papoose Dry Lake, part of the Area 51 complex south of Groom Lake. And he said the S4 facility had been built into the side of this mountain and was disguised to look like the desert if it was seen from the sky or from a satellite. Lazar didn't know at the time, but Lockheed, which has been at Area 51 from the very beginning, had already proven it was good at this kind of thing, of making a large facility look like something else. Take a look at the photos when you can, since we will be getting into some of these issues with our guest tonight. In fact, let's bring him on right now. Gene Huff has lived in Las Vegas since 1979. He met Bob Lazar in the mid-80s. He owns a real estate appraisal business. He knew Lazar before, during, and after Lazar was in this flying disc reverse engineering program at S4. He, in fact, wrote the videotape, the Lazar tape, excerpts from the government Bible, co-produced it, and he wrote a screenplay, S4, The Bob Lazar Story. It's been optioned twice by Hollywood studios, still not a movie. Anyway, Gene was sort of the unofficial spokesperson for Bob, his link to the world when all this craziness was unleashed. And, of course, John Lear, a retired airline captain, former CIA pilot, son of the famous inventor of the Lear jet. He's flown more than 150 test aircraft, won all kinds of awards, and has been our guest on this program many times. John and Gene, you there?
Yep, we're here, George. Thanks.
Thanks, guys. I think this is going to be fun. John, I want you to set the scene, sort of. 20 years ago, you know, it's hard to believe now that people didn't know about Area 51, but, I mean, you knew about it back then. You were floating around on the edge to see whatever strange things were being test flown out there, and a few other aviation buffs knew about it, and people who worked there knew about it, but largely the world didn't know about it, and it was still a secret and was pretty much unknown in the world of ufology, right?
Right. My friends, I had a couple of friends that flew the SR-71, and, of course, I hung around Van Nuys, and every Monday morning, Lockheed would depart with their three constellations with all the engineers. This is in the 60s, early 60s, or the middle 60s. And then on Friday afternoon, the three constellations would come in all in trail formation and land. And those were the engineers and that worked up there. And I never knew exactly where it was, except it wasn't too hard to figure out, you know, somewhere in the Nevada test site. And the way I figured it out is I was doing some soaring out of a little place near Pahrump, and one of the guys there, we got talking about the test site, and he made the comment. He said, yeah, I've been up there, but no Area 51 stuff. And that's the first time I heard Area 51. And, of course, from then it wasn't too hard to track it down and find out that Area 51 meant Groom Lake. I thought it was the Tonopah test range, but it wasn't. It was Groom Lake.
You started poking around out there, taking photos, some amazing photos. No, I mean, no one is ever going to get that close again of the facility itself. I've used them in a couple of documentaries, and I guess you stumbled onto information about the existence of the stealth fighter, which is how you came to KLAS and our attention and helped us break that story.
Yeah, and of course, you know, I still tell the story about the F-19, which was co-produced with the F-117A. The 117A was a cover for the F-19. The F-19, they built 62 of them, and it's still a secret, and people still don't believe it, and I have friends that, you know, worked on it and saw it fly, and, of course, the Navy used the bulk of them, and some went to Israel. But, yeah, I've got those black-and-white photos I took in 77, and I went right down to the dry lake bed. That's when there was no guard check. All there was a little booth but nobody was in the booth, and we could look across the dry lake bed, and that's when I got that picture of the MiG-21 that was sitting outside the one of the hangars. And if you go to the site where Special Projects is, they have that photo there, and that was set, and they said that's the only known photo of a MiG at Groom Lake, and that was my photo.
Man, no one will ever get that close again here. I'm sure that you made a lot of friends by publishing that photo or releasing it to the public. Gene, had you ever heard of Area 51 before you met Bob Lazar and John?
Yeah, I saw a young budding journalist named George Knapp do a program on it in Las Vegas. But that's the first I heard of it when you did that little local on the record television show.
You look back at it now, how far this story has gone, how it's changed, and how many people all over the world know about Area 51, it's really hard to remember a time, at least for most people, when it wasn't so widely known, when it wasn't so iconic.
Right. When Bob took us out there to see the disc test, not that we necessarily want to jump right in there yet, but it was as desolate as the place could be. We took an RV, and even in a vehicle of that size, we were just engulfed by desert and night sky. There wasn't a light or a human being as far as the eye could see. And after you broke Bob Lazar's story, I would say, what was it, about 12 months, there were actually tour buses taking, tours of people out to Area 51 to show them where Groom Lake was.
Okay, you saw my stories, but before then, before you had talked to Bob, had you ever heard of the place?
No, not at all. Wait, Gene,
didn't you say you watched On the Record?
Yeah.
Well, George and I talked about that a year before.
Well, that's what I said when I saw you guys on the record.
All right, I'll tell you what, guys.
I had never heard of it.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to get into the story of what you saw 20 years ago tonight. We're going into the break with Sammy Hagar, who can't seem to drive 55. Stay with us, everyone, for Coast to Coast AM. Gene, why don't you tell me how you met Bob Lazar?
Back then, I was working at a place called National Appraisal Service down on Eastern Avenue in Las Vegas, and Bob owned the, back then, this was prior to digital cameras and good appraisal software, so real estate appraisals were still typed out, and actual 35-millimeter photos were taped or pasted in the pages of a real estate appraisal, and Bob Lazar owned the photo processing lab that serviced all the residential real estate appraisers in Las Vegas, so he was Bob the photo guy.
Well, this was before he's Bob the UFO guy.
Right, right. Well, he was still a pretty eclectic fellow. I mean, he'd show up for photo deliveries in a Honda with a jet engine in it, so he wasn't your normal guy. He looked like a scientist and was certainly an interesting guy, even if he owned the photo lab. And not everybody drives a car with a jet engine around Las Vegas, but certainly not in 1985.
And you were sort of instrumental in making the link from Bob to John Lear.
Right. I had seen John on the Record with you and was really interested. I mean, John had a lot of UFO history. Would talk about Richard Nixon was in the know, and the late Jackie Gleason had a house shaped like a UFO in Florida or something like that. Did I remember that right, John?
Yeah. He was a big collector of UFO memorabilia.
Mm-hmm. And, it's just strange how it happened. I had talked to Bob and Bob's then-wife, Tracy, whose father was still working down at Los Alamos. He worked on the explosives that implode and compress the atomic material and atomic bombs. So he actually worked on implosions down at Los Alamos. So I had first talked to Tracy, Bob's wife, and then she had told me Bob had worked at Los Alamos, and he was a physicist. And I started telling her about seeing this guy John Lear on the Record and about the UFOs, and he had mentioned that that people in Los Alamos were in the know. And when Bob heard that, of course, the first thing he wanted to do was prove that he knew more than everybody else and that, he had never heard about this Los Alamos. But then when he started inquiring to some people with top secret security clearance down at Los Alamos that he knew, he found some substance to some of the things John was talking about on your show.
John, you came into the TV station, KLAS-TV, where I work, and tried to interest my mentor and friend, the late Ned Day, in looking at a pile of UFO documents. And you had some credibility with the TV station because you had helped Ned and our station break the story about the existence of the stealth fighter out there in the Nevada desert, which was an awfully big story.
That was a really interesting day because I, you know, Ned and I were good friends, and, you know, I tipped him off to this stealth fighter and stuff like that. And when I told him about this flying saucer thing, he blew me off. He said, "It's not possible, John. I would have known. I didn't know you were standing right behind me." And as I started to walk out, you said, "Hey, John, but I want to see some of your stuff." And that's how it all started.
And in the we did a show called On the Record, and one of these shows that airs at like 6 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday that nobody watches, and it's a city councilman would be on. And there's John Lear unveiling his beliefs about UFOs and government cover-ups and things, and all of a sudden the phone's ringing off the hook, and people are paying attention and calling me up, and, "Hey, when are you going to have that guy on again?" So we had him on again, had him on a third time. It was even a bigger response, and that's sort of how I got hooked on this stuff, is that I thought, gosh, this touches the pulse of the public in a way that I had never been aware of before. I couldn't figure it out. So we thought maybe we would look into this. And in that third show, John Lear hinted that he might know a guy who was working out at Area 51 on recovered alien technology. You remember that show, John?
Yeah, yeah. And you called me up in that afternoon and said, any ideas on what we can do for an encore? And I said, "Well, I have a friend that just got canned out there. Maybe he would want to talk." And then you set the whole thing up for that interview.
So through Gene Huff, you meet Bob Lazar. And
Gene called me, and he said, "I'd like to get a copy of all your tapes and stuff." And I said, "Well, I need an appraisal." And so we traded the tapes for the appraisal, and he brought over Bob Lazar to hold the measuring tape. And Gene and I are talking about UFOs, and Bob couldn't have been more disinterested. He was rolling his eyes. I mean, he thought this was all just baloney. He just couldn't believe it. He said, "Look, I worked at Los Alamos. If there had been anything like that, I would have known."
Well, first of all, you know, I had known Bob Lazar that long back then, so we weren't as all buddy-buddy as we are now. When I called John and said, "I'd like to get some of your copies of some of your stuff," the response was actually kind of, "Get lost. I don't have time for that nonsense." And then he found out I was a real estate appraiser, and he did need a real estate appraisal, and then the deal took place. And I had brought Bob with me, and it was funny because I had never seen anybody treat Bob with such disdain as John did. John just thought he was some little kid that I brought, you know, with me to hold the other end of the measuring tape when we measured his house. And about the third time that I said, "You know, he used to work down at Los Alamos," John finally listened and said, "You used to work at Los Alamos?" And then the conversation started.
So the reason I raised these questions, I mean, the issues of how you guys all met, is because there are critics out there who believe that John is somehow the evil puppet master who created this whole thing, who talked Bob into making this story up, that you guys are all in this together. But the reality is you didn't really know each other, and it kind of fell into place.
Well, and there are giant personal things going on behind the scenes here. It wasn't all, you know, this easy and cut and dried. There were a lot of coincidences that took place, you know, in Bob's personal life, things that went on that, you know, would just not really be fodder for this radio show. I mean, it sounds a lot more convenient than it was, but yeah, it was a lot of synchronicity, a lot of sheer coincidence that made things turn out the way they did.
I mean, the amazing part of it, you know, Bob the photo guy meets Gene the appraiser. Gene the appraiser knows John Lear and offers to do an appraisal in exchange for this UFO info. Bob is not the UFO guy, doesn't like the topic, doesn't think it's credible, and then suddenly gets hired out there. I mean, it is a lot to swallow that he was able to do it.
Yeah, it was that 3 months between, or 4 months between the summer of 88 and in December when Bob got hired. You know, we gave him some pieces of information, said, "Just look into this." And one of them was the YY-2 facility, and the other was the Excalibur, and there was one more thing. And this is really secret information. And so he talked to his friends back at Los Alamos, and they said, yeah, there's such a place as that. Now, that doesn't mean that's where they keep the aliens, but there was definitely a secret place. And so then he got interested, and that's when he called Dr. Teller and asked for the job out there.
We'll come back to
some. Excuse me, George, in case you hear some paper unfolding here, I'm unfolding a copy of Bob Lazar's personal daily calendar he kept on his wall from September of 88 through August of 89, so I'm ready with these dates and entries when we come back.
Yeah, he's ready with December 6th trip to nowhere.
Okay, well, I do want to get into that. I want to jump ahead, and we'll come back to this. I want to jump ahead to the trip out there into the desert 20 years ago tonight. You both, I would assume, remember it pretty well.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me how that came about and what you saw when you got out there. John, why don't we start with you?
Okay, well, the day before Tuesday, I was over at Bob's house, and he was making me a doggy death ray. And what that was my dogs were getting in Marilee's flowers, and we had to figure out a way to keep them out. So he was making an amplifier that would broadcast a high-pitched sound, which would allegedly keep them out. And in the afternoon, he just said, they're going to test fly a saucer tomorrow night. You want to go see it? And I said, well, how? And he said, well, there's a road on the northeast part of Groom Lake that leads in there, and without violating, or trespassing, we can go right up to the border and watch it because it'll be coming right above S4. And I said, well, great. Yeah, I'd love to do it. And that's how it started.
And Gene, when did he tell you and ask you the same sort of question
in
the same way?
You know, that's the way it looked from John's viewpoint. Now, behind the scenes, what a lot of people didn't know was going on was, by the way, Marilee is John's wife. We got to watch Talking So Inside here so the listening audience understands who's who when you say Marilee. And Bob's wife, then wife, they were divorced after this, had an affair. And Bob was, even at that point, kind of distraught. Bob is a peculiar personality in that he loves women, and it's not a sexual thing. Bob will do anything for women, and it could be, he used to be in love with John's 80-year-old mother, Moya. He would do anything for her, our 4-year-old little girl. He'd teach her a science lesson. Now, Bob is adopted, and a lot of psychiatrists and psychologists and armchair therapists say that, you know, Bob's mom gave him away, and so therefore he spends his life trying to, appeal to women. I mean, I don't know if there's any substance to that. Certainly it's not anything to do with his mother. His mother, Phyllis, is as wonderful of a mother as any man could ever have, so it's not like he was lacking anything in his actual life. The people that adopted him were a wonderful couple. But anyway, Bob's wife had an affair, and he was actually taking her out there to impress her, to try and keep her, and we were excess baggage. I mean, I was happy to just be in on it, and I'm sure John was too, and, you know, I would have done anything to be included with that trip, but I told John, we spoke a little bit this afternoon, that I don't think if Bob hadn't been trying to impress his wife to keep her and, you know, do anything he could to attract her back to him, I don't think any of us would have been taken out to see this. But as long as he was taking his wife out there, we got to go too. And I think he also wanted a couple of gregarious characters like John and I. He knew he was going to blow the lid off this thing, and he was going to need somebody to speak publicly to back him up if he got caught.
Well, it's an interesting point because, you know, a lot of people have asked in the years since, why would Bob violate his security oath? Why would he spill these beans? Why would he risk going to prison by talking about this stuff or by taking you guys out there and showing you the tests? And I guess you've just answered it. He was trying to hang on to his wife.
Yeah, we weren't hanging around having a beer, and he said, hey, you guys want to go see a flying saucer? He's not that kind of guy. In fact, Bob was, you know, while he was in this, I mean, he was a very peculiar personality. Here's a conversation with Bob. Oh, I'm exhausted. I'm dead tired. I was up to 3 a.m. last night. Oh, yeah, what were you doing? Why? You know, as though you're prying into his life. You know, just a casual conversation. He would start a conversation, and you'd just ask a question any friend would, and then he'd act like you were prying into his personal life. But he was paranoid. The people, Mike Thigpen, that's a long story. Anyway, who were they from?
OFI,
yeah,
Office
the OFI,
of Federal Investigation.
They were doing the security checks at his house in the middle of the night, and a lot of big things going on that in Bob's personal life, and so he had a lot of stress. He was had the possibility of losing his wife. He was in the most secret and wonderful program that a scientist could ever dream of being in. He couldn't tell his wife. He couldn't tell his friends. And when he finally broke, we were blessed because of it.
So who goes out? How many of you went? Four? Just the four?
Yeah. John and Bob and Tracy, Bob's ex-wife, and me in John's RV the first night. You take it from there, John.
Yeah, we left my house about, I think it was about 7 o'clock, and we drive out there, and we're driving up that long hill there just before you get to the pass, and the transmission broke down. And so Gene agreed to hike down to Alamo there, or to Rachel, or to Alamo, and get some transmission fluid. So we were delayed about an hour while he goes down and gets it. We poured it in. It works again. We drive up. We get to the cutoff, the Groom Lake Road there, and drive down that long dirt road. So it's now it's about 8:15, 8:30, and we drive down this long, long road to about as far as we thought we could go without getting in trouble. And then we pull over. We get out. I had my 8-inch Celestron telescope, which I set up. And Bob said it's going to be at 9 o'clock. They test at 9 o'clock. So we all waited, and I'm trying to focus in the Celestron 8, which, is really tough to do. And there it comes, right against the hill, just as advertised, at 9 o'clock. And this thing comes up and starts flying around. And, of course, it's very difficult to focus with the Celestron 8, and I couldn't get focused until it stopped in midair and started descending. And that's when I said, I got it. And, what I saw was a flying disc. It was oriented about 45 degrees to the horizon. It was radiating a yellowish, goldish kind of stuff that was coming off it. And I said, here, quick, Gene, take a look. And as I stepped back, I hooked my foot around the tripod and moved the telescope. And, of course, Gene's never forgiven me.
It was the most tragic, trip ever in history, an extraterrestrial disc in the middle of an 8-inch Celestron telescope, and John's foot hooked the tripod and jarred it, and then the disc had gone down below the mountain range. But
could you see it with your naked eye?
Well, we had binoculars out there,
right, too.
Yeah, and he's right about the glow coming off of it and everything that happened. Another peculiar thing was this past Sunday, a week ago today, my son Daniel turned 20, and, of course, which means that, the night this happened, I've got a 7-day-old baby, my first and only child, and my in-laws, my wife's parents are out here staying with us, and I'm pretty much a homeboy. I'm not one to up and go drinking with the boys in the middle of the week. So here on a Wednesday night, after dark with a 7-year-old baby and my in-laws in town, I excuse myself and say I'm going out for the evening, which was pretty unusual. I didn't tell them where I was going or anything, but nothing would have kept me from joining everyone on that trip.
So Bob Lazar tells you when it's going to this test flight's going to take place. Sure enough, it turns out to be accurate. You see this thing. I mean, what a feeling that might have been. What must have been? What a rush!
Right,
it really was. And I hear these stories occasionally. People say, that Bob, he doesn't have a degree. We can't trace it down. So if he worked out there, he must have been a cook. Well, my answer to that is, if he was a cook, then they tell all the cooks when the secret test flights are going to be made on the flying saucers.
Right. I mean, it's a big point that he knew when the flights would take place, because there had been no news stories about that. There had been no discussion about it in UFO circles or UFO magazines. He knew when they'd take place, and whatever it was that was flying out there, it looked like a flying saucer, and he knew about it. So I don't know how you explain that one away.
And we didn't mistake. People go, oh, yeah, well, you probably mistook the stealth fighter or whatever. Well, John Lear probably knows a little more about jets and airplanes than anybody you'll run into walking down the street. And we didn't mistake an airplane. I mean, I think the collective knowledge there was smart enough, though, that there was no fixed-wing aircraft that we were seeing. And, in fact, Jim Taliani, another mutual friend of ours, was actually working on a Tonopah test range then. He didn't have his clearance yet, but the stealth fighters were still out at TTR then. So we didn't mistake a terrestrial craft for an ET craft. That mistake did not happen.
How long was the thing in the air that you could see?
I don't know. What would you say, John? Maybe 10, 15 minutes?
Yeah,
like
less
that?
Than that. Maybe 6 to 8 minutes, because I remember it was right at 9 o'clock. And then we did that videotape that they played on TV the other night. And the video camera, I think it was like 9:05 or 9:06 or something, that when we were, castigating each other. You know, there's a video camera ready to go, and it's sitting on the bumper while we're watching, you know, the greatest thing in history, and nobody thought to pick it up.
But it was exhilarating, though. I mean, it was it's hard to believe it was us. You hear this story, and it was just unbelievable.
Now, at the time, are you worried about getting caught? Was Bob worried about getting caught?
Yeah,
that first night
we were concerned. That's what some of us had the binoculars on the disc, and others had binoculars on the desert to see, keep an eye on the security guys to see if anybody would come out to chase us.
Okay, so it was so much fun. He decides to do it again, right? In the next 2 weeks, you went out again, same
right.
group, slightly different group.
Okay, now the next time, the next Sunday or the next Wednesday night was March 29th, and that night I was flying with. American Transair, and I had a trip to Minneapolis. So on the Tuesday night, I called Bob and I said, "What are you guys going out?" Or I said, "What are you going to do?" And he said, "We're going fishing." And so that was the secret code word. We're going up to Groom Lake.
In fact, on his calendar here, John, Wednesday the 29th, it says Jim, me, his wife, and it says fishing in parentheses underlined. That's what the entry is on Bob's calendar for that day.
So then
the third night was April 6th, and that was going to be the big night when we got, you know, we had the Geiger counter, the video cameras, the stuff and everything, and there was me, Gene, Bob, Tracy's wife, and Tracy. And that's the night we got caught.
All right. We'll save that story for when we come back after the break, how it all went downhill, at least for Bob Lazar, and how the story eventually broke as a result. Stay with us, our guests, John Lear and Gene Huff, on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. Welcome back, everyone. Our guests, John Lear and Gene Huff, talking about the early days, the origins of the Area 51 story, and Bob Lazar. Let's go back, John. You were talking before the break about this third trip that the group took up. Yes?
I hate to interrupt, but I think we should step back to March 29th for a second. John
okay.
was out of town and didn't go. March 29th, we went out there again, and it was myself and Bob's ex-wife, Tracy, Bob and Jim Taliani, our mutual friend that worked out at Tonopah Test Range. And this was the night when the disc actually came the furthest, I guess, north up the mountain range, where we actually got the closest look. And of course, after not getting any video of it that first night when John was there, we had a video camera, and Bob Lazar remembered to get some video, which is the famous video that's been shown on your specials of the disc jumping around in the sky. And this was when I told the story of how unusual it is to see a craft using gravity propulsion, which I speak matter-of-factly of now. I mean, I didn't know that's what I was seeing then. I was certainly a novice speaking about any of this. But the craft would be a long way away, and like it was when we saw it the first time when John was there, the amber, I guess, colored glow sort of coming off of it. Unlike a train coming toward you on train tracks or a car on a highway, the human brain and eye is used to seeing objects move, and I guess we calculate geometrically the speed and, you know, whether it's going to intersect with us, or that's how we anticipate something coming at us. I guess it's similar to an animal, you know, when to flee, when to run, when to stand and fight. And anyway, the disc would, you'd be looking at it and you wouldn't see it come toward you. You'd just blink and suddenly it would be closer and you'd go, now, did that happen or am I seeing things? And then you're still standing there looking at it, and then you'd blink and suddenly it'd be a lot closer. And this was alarming to your mind because you didn't see it travel at any particular speed toward you. It would just jump and suddenly it would be nearer. And to the point where it came far enough down the mountain range that it glowed very brightly. We actually backed up behind the trunk lid because it started to glow so brightly. I guess, I don't know if we thought it was going to explode or what. I mean, Bob didn't explain that was just the glow from the you know, electrical power dancing around on the static charge, I guess, on the skin of the disc. So we backed up and actually went behind the trunk lid. That's how close it came and how fearful we were of it. But that's the night Bob Lazar got the video, and that's the closest we ever did see it come down the mountain range.
Hey, okay, so after the first one and the second one, the trips out there where you saw these things, were you able to get any other information out of Bob, or was he still being kind of closed mouthed? Did you ask him, hey, you really do work out there? How did you know about this? What are those craft? And did he get into the propulsion technology, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, he would use the old demonstration of folding a dollar bill in half and showing how they distorted space and time to travel rather than flying in a straight line in a linear mode. But, he knew his phone was tapped. There were always noises on his phone. He had marital problems with his wife. I mean, he was very up and down emotionally. So, no, it wasn't a big party where you have a beer and go, now tell me about those flying saucers. It didn't happen. I mean, he let us in on that. But it wasn't a big UFO free-for-all answering all the questions and telling us the secrets of the universe. I know that sounds strange, but that's the way it was.
And I guess the personal question would be, did it work? Did it impress? I mean, he's taken his wife out there to impress her and keep his marriage together. Did that part of it work? Was she impressed?
Well, here's the answer. On April 10th, Bob's entry in his calendar says life equals zero. So I would say no.
John, it must have been driving you crazy to have seen these things. I know what an inquisitive mind you have. You must have had a million questions for him. Were you getting answers?
Well, you know, the big night was in December. The first time we went out there was December 6th. And I came home from a trip, I think a couple days later, and I'm sitting at my desk, and he came over, and I'm just writing out some checks, and he just casually mentions, I saw a disc today. And I said, what? And he said, I saw a disc today. And I said, theirs or ours? He said, theirs. I said, well, what are you doing here? I said, they've obviously followed you out here. They're going to find out you're telling me stuff. Why don't you work for a couple of months and then tell me? And these are his exact words. He said, no, John. He said, you've taken so much crap over this for the past few months that I've known you. I wanted to tell you that it's real. I was there. I touched it. I was in it. And it's real. And so then we spent about 2 hours talking, and he would say, he said, I can only answer questions. I can't volunteer information. Now, why he said that, I don't know, but that's exactly what he said.
So. Well, part of that, John, was the security guys had found out that Bob knew John Lear, and they wanted Bob to interact with John to see if John really knew anything about the actuality of what was going on there. So while John was listening to Bob, Bob was listening to John and reporting to the security guys what John said. So that's why Bob behaved like that, is he was spying on John.
So whatever night that was in December, it was shocking to me, because I remember we wrapped up the evening. He walked out. We stood at the front door. We looked up at a star, and I said, now, if I wanted to go there, I said, and I had a craft, do I just head towards it? He said, no, you go to the right. And so then he explained how that happened, or how that worked. And I remember walking inside and standing in my den and just standing there for about 10 minutes, just totally, totally awestruck at the information that I had been told that night. Because, of course, you know, I believed it. You know, the stuff that I knew, I thought it was true. But for somebody to say, yes, I saw it, it's true, you know, the whole thing is true. I mean, that was really something. That really, it took about, you know, several months for it to sink in, for you to really believe that, yes, it's true. There are aliens. They are visiting us. And Bob did work on their craft.
So there's John, you can authenticate that after he started telling us things, it still wasn't a free-for-all where he'd just answer questions and, right? I mean, he'd still be closed-mouthed about things. I sensed a type of paranoia, I guess. He had people, you know, doing random security checks at his house, but it was never until much later just a big party where he just entertained and answer every question he could about the craft, right?
Right.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
One thing about the phone taps is my phone was tapped, too, and I had a guy from it was Centel in, and I had a couple of teenage daughters. By the way, Jackie and Allie and Moy and Jill are listening tonight. Hello to
Good.
Them. Allie and Jax had telephones and were always changing their numbers and always changing rooms and everything. And so we knew the Centel guy. So one day he's out here, and this is like in December, January, when all this is going on. And he comes down to my den after, you know, working on a project. He says, John, your phone's tapped. And I said, yeah, well, I'm not surprised. He says, well, do you mind if I check and see where the tap is? I said, no, you know, if it doesn't cost anything, no, it doesn't. So he came back in about a half an hour, and he said, you know, I've been down Monroe and down Hollywood and down Bonanza, and the tap is further than that. And I said, well, don't worry about it. I said, all our phones are tapped. You know, we're into this flying saucer stuff. He says, no, I just want to check. So the next morning he shows up about 10 o'clock. He says, John, I can't work on your phones anymore. I said, why not? He said, I traced your tap, and it's a mainframe, and there is no paperwork for it. And I took it to my boss, told her about it, and she said, if you don't like it, you can quit.
Wow.
And so that was a pretty interesting time.
Yeah, we should also point out that there was another tap that became relevant to Bob's life. In fact, that's how he found out that his wife was having an affair, and we'll get into that story and then go back to the big confrontation with the security guys when we come back. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Knapp, joined by Gene Huff and John Lear, talking about the early days of the Area 51 story, the legend. Gene, you'd mentioned earlier, and we don't want to get too much into Bob's personal life, but it is relevant to the larger story that he learned that his wife had been having an affair, and I think it was with her flight instructor at the time. Tell us how he learned that.
Well, by the way, I wanted to interject here while John and I say Bob told us this, and Bob took us out there and showed us that, and it's important for someone listening to understand the emotional uproar in Bob's life. I mean, here's a guy who is going to work on call. He's not even on a steady schedule yet. And when he's at work, you know, he's done everything from read reports on, you know, an alien civilization and seen alien bodies vivisectioned and weighed and ultimately actually, you know, went inside and touched a flying disc that, you know, as far as he could tell it, as far as was told to him, was brought here from another star system, along with seeing another eight beside the one that he touched and was in. In addition to having, you know, being in the process of losing the love of his life, you know, this guy was an emotional mess when this was going on. So not everything makes sense and probably sounds as perfect as it could or should have been. But, you know, it was a bad time in Bob's life when this was going on. Now, you want to know how he found out she was having an affair?
Yeah, John and you were both talking about security measures. John mentioned that his phone, he believed, was tapped.
Well, you know, ultimately, the guys at the OPM, at the, what were we going to call them?
The OFI, Office of Federal.
The OFI, yeah, who worked for the OPM, Office of Personnel Management. The OFI had his phone tapped, and they had heard his wife having conversations with her boyfriend over the phone. They didn't know whether Bob knew or not, so they already knew that they were going to, that if Bob lost his wife, he would be in emotional turmoil and be a security risk, so they were going to at least temporarily yank his clearance, but they couldn't do that until they knew that he knew that his wife was having an affair. They knew before he did. And so ultimately she confessed and told him she was having an affair. And if I remember correctly, she called her mother over the phone, I think, or maybe it was her father, in another state, and said, you know, I'm messed up in the head. I'm in emotional turmoil. I've been having an affair, and I told Bob. And when the guys at the
on the other end.
At the OFI heard, now they knew, Bob knew his wife was having an affair. And coincidentally, this all happened on the day or the day before Bob took us out for the last, to witness the last disc test. So all of this came down when, I guess we should go into how we got caught out in Central Nevada.
Yeah, let's tell that story.
Go ahead, John, you take over.
Okay, so it was Tracy and her sister and Bob and me and Gene. We get in the car. We start down the road and towards the lake bed. And the question was, how far do we go? And I kept saying, I was riding shotgun. I guess saying, well, let's stop here because, you know, even a mile closer isn't going to help us, you know, get any clearer shots. So they decided, well, let's go a little bit further. We went further and further, and all of a sudden, two sets of headlights come on in front of us, and they, just right at the same time. And so we thought, well, there could be a problem here. So I told Tracy's sister, I said, she was driving, I said, now, careful when you turn around because we don't want to get stuck in the dirt here. So we turn around and we go racing down this dirt road.
Now, our lights are off also, John. They don't want her to hit the brake lights because they'll see our brake lights. Go ahead.
So we go racing down this road, and it's obviously they're going to catch us. So we decide, and this is before we got to the highway, we decide, well, let's pull over. We'll jump out. I'll set up the telescope. And if they ask us what we're doing, we'll just say we're looking at the stars. And
now, John, just to interject here, prior to that, we stopped, and when we knew we were going to get caught, Bob got out of the car, took the gun, and just in case of rattlesnakes, and went running across the desert toward the highway so he wouldn't get caught with us. Now, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, but that was the last stop. So we jump out. I get the telescope out. I start setting it up. Bob runs out in the desert with a gun, and we're all standing around there, and then the two cars show up, skid into a stop, and the security guys get out, and they've got the guns. And
they were big guys, too.
Are they pointing guns at you?
No, they're on their shoulder. They're slung on their shoulder.
So before they got out, I ran up to the car, and to their car, and I put my hands on the top of the car, and I said, you guys aren't dopers, are you? Yeah, we thought you were chasing us, you know. And they said, no, we're not dopers. We'd like to ask you a few questions. So they asked us what we're doing out there, and we say we're looking at the stars. And then they said, well, then why were you driving so fast away from us? And, of course, nobody had an answer for that. So they said, okay, well, we need to see some driver's licenses and Social Security numbers. So we gave them our Social Security numbers, and I guess we were there.
Wait, John, is that true? Because I thought it was you. I didn't think we presented ID to them. We presented ID to the sheriff later.
That's right. That's right. But we told them our Social Security numbers then.
Right. Right.
So we gave them our Social Security numbers. I guess it was about a half an hour. They came back and they said, okay, now look, we can't kick you off this land because it belongs to BLM, but we can give you an awful lot of problems if you stay here. And so they jump in their car, and we thought they drove away.
They said, we'd like to have you up on the highway. If you're looking at stars, the stars will look just as good from up there.
So the trunk is open because I had gotten the telescope out, and it's bright, so we can't see too much except what's in right around the car. So anyway, we wait for about 10, 15 minutes, and here Bob comes out of the desert. And so he tells us this fantastic story. He says, boy, I had the 9mm pointed right at them. If they were going to come at me, I was going to blow them away, da-da-da-da-da. So unbeknownst to us, the security had parked about 100 meters down the road, turned off their car, and they were recording us. They were taking video, and they had this parabolic mic, and they were recording what we were saying.
Well, also, John, remember, I guess they were watching us through night vision goggles, and you and I saw a green glowing thing kind of drop as though somebody had them at their eyes and dropped them down hanging around their neck, and we saw this green light. And I said, did you see that? And you were the one that said, yeah, those must be night vision goggles. So they were watching us also.
Yeah, but yeah, I guess I didn't put it together that it was them that had the night vision goggles. But anyway, so Bob tells his story, and we're laughing and joking and telling about flying saucers and everything and not realizing that we were being recorded. So we break down the telescope, put it in the back of the car, and shut the trunk. And
now, in the trunk also, we've got a Geiger counter, a telescope, video cameras, gun. We were really equipped that night for everything. Go ahead.
So we drive up, and just as we hit the highway, what is it, Lincoln County? Lincoln County or Knight County, Sheriff?
Lincoln.
What is it?
Lincoln.
Yeah.
Lincoln County
Sheriff puts on the lights, the siren, and everything. And
Officer LaMoureux.
Yeah. What was his first name?
Doug.
What is it?
Yeah. Doug.
Doug LaMoureux, yeah. I got a good story about him. Anyway, so over the loudspeaker says, get out of the car, put your hands on top of the, you know, on top of the car, and, you know, we're all doing that anyway, but he keeps saying it louder, and, you know, we're thinking, all right, we're doing it, you know. He says, get out of the car, put your hands on top of the car. So we're all standing there, five of us with our hands on top of the car, and so he says, okay, well, now I've only got two questions here. Is number one, why are there five people in the car here and there was only four when you were on the test site, and where's the gun? So it was really funny because we were there for about an hour, and he never did recover the gun.
Well, we didn't give him permission to search the trunk. And he kept us there as long as he legally could without taking us in. He said, I'd have to take you in if I'm going to detain you any longer, but, you know, just stay away from here and no more shenanigans. And then he let us go.
So Gene's kidding me here is because Doug Lamoureux, the sheriff, says, okay, I need to see some driver's license. And like a complete idiot, and I admit it, I was a complete idiot. I said, my driver's license is in my jacket in the trunk. And of course, neither Bob or Gene will ever forgive me for that. But so I guess I said, oh, no, it's not in the trunk. And Doug says, open the trunk.
Oh, boy.
So we opened the trunk, but he didn't search it. He just
took a peek.
I got out my license, and that was probably one of the weirdest hours in my life, is we're all standing in front of the car, in front of Doug Lamoureux. He's got those two questions. He says, look, he says, no problem. I can get a search warrant. He says, either you... you know, tell me what I need to know, or you know, we're going to take you in. So it was really interesting. We shuffled there, and nobody made any comment. And then after about an hour, Doug says, okay, I don't know what the deal is here, and I don't know why I'm being told this, but I'm told to let you go. So,
okay, I'll tell you what, we're going to stop the story there, pick it up after the break. We're going into the break talking with Gene Huff and John Lear about Area 51. And welcome back, everyone. Gene Huff, John Lear, talking about Area 51. Let's pick up the story, fellas, where you've just got caught by the security guys and then by the sheriff. They take down this information. How quickly does that filter back to Bob's employers?
George, I think we should first interject also. That night, the third night, we had rented a car. That's why they couldn't run plates and get any ID or info on any of us, because we had to rent a car. So that kind of... baffled Lamoureux also. That's why he couldn't find out who we were without our IDs. Okay.
Let me put it this way. Had there been a disc flight while all this is going on, obviously you're not paying much attention to what's going on over the hills, but did they have a test flight that night, or did you see it?
I don't remember seeing one.
I don't think we saw anything that night.
Okay, so how quickly do things go downhill for Bob as a result of what happened out there?
Well, on his calendar here, it says he called that night bad day at Groom, and the next day it says debriefed at work. So the very next day he went in, he was called in to go to work, and he went to the EG&G terminal, which no longer exists. That, if you remember, you guys do because you're in Las Vegas, the EG&G terminal at that point in time abutted Sunset Road, not far east of the Las Vegas Strip. And he went there, and Dennis Mariani, who was the security guy that shadowed him when he was at S4, said that Bob started to go toward the plane to take the jet out to land at Area 51. And Dennis said, we won't be going that way tonight. And they took a car and actually drove out to Indian Springs Air Force Base, where Bob got a very nasty debriefing. And they showed him, they asked him why he took all of his friends and family out there to watch the disc test. He said, that's kind of what we meant when we told you this was above top secret, you know, that we didn't want you to tell everybody about it. And they showed him a stack of transcripts of everything on his phone lines, including his wife Tracy talking with her boyfriend, and said that now that he knew his pretty little wife was having an affair, he was a security risk, and that they were going to yank his security clearance for some period of time. I don't remember the duration, but he could reapply, you know, months or whenever down the road when he'd be more emotionally stable.
Well, isn't that astonishing that they would say that he could come back to the program after he has obviously, you know, spilled the beans to people without clearances?
You know, that is a good question, and I've discussed that with Bob, and we really concluded that probably the decision on what to do with him was done at a higher level. They had to do something immediately, right? They got a guy from the program taking people out there to watch the disc test. They've got to reprimand him and kick him out. But what to do with him for the long term had to come from wherever, Washington, D.C., wherever, whoever, you know, whoever calls the shots, whoever that may be or they may be, may not have known, you know, by that next day. I think they had to decide what to do. This was the interim reprimand. And in fact, it definitely was, because they had called him and told him that they wanted to come back out to work. And he said, no, I'm not going. And they said, are you refusing? He said, yeah, I'm not coming out there anymore. So they did call to have further intercourse with Bob Lazar, but he wouldn't go back out.
Yeah, he was worried what might happen to him out there.
Right, right.
Now, one of the interesting things they told him in the debriefing is when they started it, they said, when you talked to John Lear and said you were going fishing, that really threw us for a loop.
Yeah, that really fooled us. Fishing
John,
is real right.
But you know, go ahead.
To show the roller coaster that this guy's life was on. Now, he's losing his wife. Now, here on a day in April, you know, on his daily calendar, he writes, his life was so mundane that here at the beginning of April, he wrote the entry, we turned house air conditioner on and car air conditioner on. He actually recorded what day he turned his home and car air conditioning on. The next day it says bad day at Groom, and the next day it says debriefed at work. So he goes from having so little going on that he's writing he turned his air conditioner on to going to see show us a disc desk at Groom to getting debriefed at Indian Springs Air Force Base. And that's the roller coaster this guy was on at that point in time.
John, you know all the criticisms of the story that have surfaced over the years, and people, understandably, there are problems with it. There are gaps. There are things that don't seem to make sense. Part of the one that really sticks in people's craws is how Bob could be out there without a clearance, you know, in a short period of time. When you consider all the strange things in his life, you know, the questions about his educational credentials, things of that sort, the fact that he knows you, and then he brings people out to see this test flight, and they still are talking to him about working for him. That a lot of people have trouble buying all that.
I'd have trouble buying it if it didn't happen to me. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
But, George, you know, this brings up a good point, and a lot of scientists, in fact, that email you have trouble with this, because they all say, look, I've got a PhD. I'm one of the foremost scientists in that field. And certainly they would have chosen me before Bob Lazar. And, of course, your credentials weren't necessarily the criteria. I mean, Bob's adopted. Bob's a renegade. You know, I who am I to say what the criteria is? But they have to decide who will be helpful, who can take it. I mean, let's face it, there are philosophical, theological ramifications to all of this, and they don't just let – it wasn't a contest of who has the greatest credentials, that's who gets in this program. And this offends some people. You know, certainly if they would have wanted great scientists, well, they would have chosen me, so therefore I don't believe this is going on. But the criteria was, wouldn't you say, John, was never who had the greatest credentials.
Yeah, it was who they could probably discredit the easiest if he ever said anything about it.
And the fact that Bob had a chance meeting with Edward Teller, and that, you know, just a word from the late Dr. Edward Teller probably meant a lot. I mean, you know, who knows how all of that happened, but Bob did. You know, we still don't know the totality, other than what Bob told us of what he did down at the Maison Physics facility down at Los Alamos. I mean, he did have a background. People have told John, you have other CIA guys have told you that they love to take adopted people and orphans and people that they can, you know, get rid of and get rid of their personal information and have no family looking for them. Right.
Right? Just so they can shoot them and nobody will say, hey, what happened to my dad and stuff like that.
And the idea of that they would take somebody with gaps in their background, John, and you mentioned it. And maybe he was one of the most qualified guys in the country. If you were looking for someone with scientific and technical capabilities and expertise, but who could just be easily destroyed if the need arose.
Right. He told us about he had three interviews after he called Dr. Teller. He was called in, and the first interview. They were all, I guess, technical interviews. And he told us after he did those interviews, each one, he said, I aced it. And he told us exactly what they asked and what his answers were. And they were of a highly technical nature. The only interesting thing was on the second interview, the first question was, now tell us about John Lear and what your relationship is with John Lear. And he says, I know John Lear. But I think he sticks his nose in places where it doesn't belong. And Bob said what he didn't tell him is he also likes to stick his nose into places it doesn't belong.
You know, here's a funny thing. Remember I told you that Bob loves to appease women. And while he was still, John, you aren't going to like me saying this, when he was still trying to do whatever he could to impress his wife, to keep her and attract her back, here's an entry here that they took a flight when he was ferrying an L-1011. So Bob's wife was taking flying lessons. Now, she doesn't even have a private pilot's license. John lets her fly an L-1011 in the pilot's chair. And what did you give her, 20 or 30 minutes of flight time? John, in that L-1011?
Hello, no comment.
So there's another attempt at trying to get his woman back. Someone named John let him fly an L-1011. Maybe it wasn't John Lear.
Yeah, there's plenty of guys named John in this world.
You both have heard the criticism that maybe this was a setup, that they had got Bob for this job just precisely so they could do exactly that. They figured he's kind of a rebel and a troublemaker, and there's no way he's going to be able to keep this secret. We'll tell him some stuff. He'll go ahead and spill the beans, and we'll all have a good laugh about it. What do you think about that, starting with you, John?
Certainly plausible. I've always thought that, possibly that they were trying to get the information out, and they said, Lear's interested in this. Let's work this out so, you know, he can get the information out. And I've always told Bob, we tried our best, but we didn't do a very good job.
But when you extrapolate that out, then there must have been some people who wanted to get it out and some who didn't, right? I think there was a conflict there, because if they all wanted to, if it was a consensus that they wanted to get it out, you know, it could have been accomplished. You know what I mean? They certainly tried to prevent it after the fact.
Well, the effect was they put it out and they drew it back. I mean, you know, you allowed Bob to spill those beans, allowed us to tell the stories, and then in the eyes of a lot of people, discredited him entirely.
But they told him when he was there, he asked them, how do you keep this secret? And they said, it's the easiest thing in the world to keep secret, that as long as you don't prove anything one way or the other, as long as you keep people on the fence and, you know, ridicule those who believe or who think they've seen proof, ridicule them and just dismiss the rest, it's an easy thing to keep secret, because everybody wants to say, oh, there's no life anywhere else that we've discovered. You know, why would we have the SETI project? Why, you know, but and as a counterpoint, George, look at all the information you've amassed from civilian pilots, military pilots, I mean, confirmed with ground radar, air radar, an actual sighting by pilots. It's something moving thousands of miles an hour past an airliner. And a long time ago, before it could possibly be any terrestrial aircraft, in the 50s, you know, a crew of Air Force men. And yet everybody goes, well, I wonder what that was. You know, they even though it couldn't possibly have been a craft from Earth piloted by human beings, they still don't conclude that that must be something or someone from somewhere else. So,
or our government saying, well, gosh, this can't be a threat to national security, so we're not going to worry about it. I mean, craft that can outfly anything you've got, that demonstrate mastery over things like nuclear missiles and can even enter nuclear codes on your most powerful weapon systems. I mean, if that is not national security stuff, I don't know what is.
Right. And there is no one there, you know, from the biggest skeptic. I mean, if everyone was intelligent and honest, if anyone people who dismiss the possibility that there's life elsewhere and that that life has been here, that it is here or that it has been here, you know, in antiquity, if they actually read and examined the evidence, they could do nothing but conclude that there is life somewhere else and that life has visited the Earth. But it's easier to not examine it and just say, well, why don't they land on the White House lawn? And since they haven't, I don't believe it.
What about the idea that they allowed this story to be told, used Bob to tell it, used the rest of us to tell it, so that they could distract attention from something else, maybe something else that was a legitimate earthly made technology out there? What do you think about that, John?
Very plausible. Yeah, they had a lot of things to cover up. I think the they kind of mastered the cover up there with the F-117 because the F-19 was a secret. It still is a secret. We haven't heard of any brand new, really super sophisticated airplanes except the F-22, and that's old technology. And certainly, you know, after 20-25 years, they have stuff that's really, really out of this world as far as technology.
And to that end, whatever that end was, they'd have alien beings vivisection. I'm not saying I'm naive, and I know what great lengths they could go to program someone. But I always say, to what end? I mean, they go, you know, is that the best thing they could come up with? We're afraid that someone's going to see our new spy plane. So I'll tell you what, let's try and make everyone think that, you know, flying saucers and there's light. You know, that's a pretty touchy subject. I mean, it touches theology and philosophy. There must be a better way is what I'm thinking.
Well, my thought is, if that really was the plan, that they had an idea that let's tell this crazy UFO story, then destroy the credibility of the story, and we'll distract attention away from whatever is flying around out there, whatever secret projects we've got going at this very, very valuable base. That policy was a miserable failure and backfired on them, because to this day, you've still got people going out there with binoculars and telescopes to see whatever it is that's flying around in the sky. You've had tens of thousands of people who've made the trek out into the desert. You've had every major news organization in the world gone out there to look around. You've had congressional investigators and all kinds of media attention. If they didn't want attention for something that was going on out there, somebody really screwed up.
Not only there, but everywhere. There's nowhere in the world that people aren't looking, you know, as a reaction to that, probably. And so just because you can't get away with it there, you probably can't get away with it anywhere that there are human beings.
The idea that some people have raised, that Bob was part of this thing, that he was a disinformation agent working with this government. John, how would you respond to that?
That he was a different disinformation agent?
Yeah, that he was working with them to tell this story and stir the pot.
It's certainly plausible. I don't believe it, but, you know, he could have been.
You know, I've heard that before. And first of all, I even heard Bob say, you know, had they asked me to do that, I probably would have participated. He doesn't deny that he would be a guy that would do that if they asked him. However, he is the worst guy in the world. Bob can't, you know, his memory, he can't keep. He treats most subjects with such disdain. He wouldn't waste his time. And Bob told that same story. You know, he would be the worst guy in the world to make up a lie and trying to perpetuate a lie. He's too busy being productive doing other things. I mean, he would be the worst guy to include that type of endeavor.
One of the threads that's out now, and we're going to cover some ground that where the controversy still rages over whether he's a legit guy or not, whether there really was a program like this out there. Something I saw on Above Top Secret, a thread, just saw it yesterday, talking about Papoose Lake, and these guys theorize that since they cannot see any roads on their Google shots of Papoose Lake leading from Groom down to Papoose, therefore there was never a facility there. You want to tackle that one, John?
Yeah. Google is monitored by the Department of Defense, and every sensitive area is airbrushed. And if you don't believe that, just go to the Nevada test site. There's a huge new facility called Sandia. There's two huge new runways. It's about a third of the way from Tonopah Test Range to Groom Lake. Many of my friends have been there. Many of people work there, and there's nothing visible on Google. Go to Wake Island or Johnston Island or Midway Island, where the military has a huge presence now, and all there is just plain sand and stuff, and there's huge operations out there. And so all of this stuff anybody that thinks they're using Google and can find out any information, all the good stuff is airbrushed down.
Well, I remember seeing satellite photos where you could see roads out there. In fact, I've got one hanging on my wall right now. I'm pretty sure that the guys who have worked at Area 51 who've come forward, who've talked about, and they don't buy the saucer story, but they said that there were other kinds of test flights out at Papoose, that they've used it for a number of years.
Yeah, in 1990, they moved the real sensitive stuff up north, just south of Wendover. And you got those maps I sent you?
Yeah, so you think that they, as a result of this story breaking, that they moved all the sensitive stuff somewhere else?
I think it was already being built at that time, but they did move it all up there. It's out the window of, or just to the east of Highway 93 Alternate, and I have friends that work there, and it's really a huge facility, and it's very, very secret. It's the new Area 51, but, you know, it's 20 years old now.
And, so, George, I think it's naive. I mean, what year was it you won the Emmy Award for UFOs the Best Evidence, a two-hour UFO special? I don't know if people elsewhere would know. People in Las Vegas that were around then would know that. And by that next year, they were taking tour buses out to Central Nevada. So it would be naive to think that they kept doing disc tests on Wednesday night after dark, after, you know, essentially the entire world was informed of it. That program was definitely moved. This is what's funny about...
Well, I tell you what, hold that thought, because when we come back, we'll get into discussing how Area 51 story went across the world like a tsunami. Stay with us for our conversation with Gene Huff and John Lear. Beatles, take us into the break. Welcome back, everyone. We're talking about the Area 51 story, and I know the broad strokes of this story are well known to many of our listeners who are wondering why we're covering the same stuff. And what I had hoped with this conversation with Gene Huff and John Lear is that we fill in some of the blanks, and that is the small stuff that happened. The broad strokes are well known. The story has gone all over the world, of course. It's the small stuff, the details about the trips out there to see the saucers, that I think are important in the chain of evidence about the story. You know, the point being, how did Bob know? You know, if he's a fraud, as many people believe, and they have some reasons to believe that, how did he know the test flights would take place on Wednesday nights? Because the witnesses, two of whom we're talking to tonight, went out there, they videotaped it, they saw it, it really did happen. How did he know? There are many questions that have been raised about his academic credentials, and we'll get into some of that as well. But it's the small stuff, and what the people who were directly involved with Bob lived through, that I think is very telling. And every day I get inquiries about the Area 51 story, and I'm sure you guys do too, from a whole new round of folks out there who've just discovered the Area 51 story and are curious about it, which is... Now, part of the reason we're covering this, what I'd like to go into for the next couple of minutes is what it was like during that time period, because it was a tumultuous time. A lot of things were going on. You guys lived through it. I lived through some of it. And it was there were some strange things that really were happening, which the people who don't believe the story and don't want to accept it have hard times accepting. Gene, why don't you start it off? I mean, you were really close to Bob. You lived through it. You know what happened in the months and years afterward. Why don't you just give me a general sense of what it was like then?
Well, after he went on television and did we get that far yet, I guess?
No, we haven't got that far.
I just see where we're at here. Well, first of all, he was destroyed. Eventually, Tracy left, and Bob was a broken man. I mean, borderline suicidal. He was just literally physically sick, and he was destroyed emotionally. So now look what he's gone through. He's gone from, you know, being in between scientific jobs, working at Los Alamos, running a little photo processing lab out of his home, amongst the many other projects. I mean, Bob's a productive guy. He's always doing something with science and technology, jet cars, things like that. And he goes and gets into this program, gets exposed to alien hardware, gets caught, gets kicked out of the program, loses his wife. I mean, he was a broken man. I mean, he really felt he had nothing left to live for at that point in time. Yet the heat was still on when they called him and demanded that he report back out to work, and he told them no. Well, now he not only were there clicks on all of our phone lines, he started being followed. One time he went to work out at a gym with Shelley Ball, who is Jim Taliani's significant other, the guy that we mentioned before, worked out at Tonopah Test Range. And he had, and Bob owned an Uzi, not full automatic, but semi-automatic Uzi. And they went in and worked out at the gym. When they come out, the doors to Bob's car standing wide open, and it had been, they'd rifled through the papers in there, yet the Uzi is still sitting there on the floor. So if it was just some punks who broke into his car, they certainly would have stolen that Uzi. Instead, his car is just left with the doors standing wide open, his gun still in there. Things like that happened. I'd be at my appraisal office. We were all not carrying guns. That would have been illegal. But there were guns at the place, the buildings we were at that point in time. And Bob would stop by on his photo route. I'd be sitting there doing real estate appraisal. He'd come in with his face all red and say, give me your gun. And I'd hand him a gun. And he'd go back out in his car. There'd be people chasing him around. When he was getting on Highway 15 one time, a government-looking vehicle with blacked-out windows pulled up next to him and was chasing him, and they pulled up next to him. The window rolled down, and they shot his tire out.
That's the night he stayed over at my place, slept on the couch because
right.
He was scared to go home.
Right. He didn't want to go back to his house. And he came home the one night, and his entire house had been rifled through. The front door had been broken open. The deadbolt had been broken open, and people had looked through his house and left the door ajar and everything messed up. So not only were they after him, they wanted him to be paranoid. They wanted him to know that they were listening to his phone and that they were following him. So
they write something on his blackboard or something like that, or erase something? Or
Yeah, I think so. I don't remember specifically what it was, but there were a whole host of paranoid situations that Bob was going through, and he was in no shape. He was out there on the edge anyway. It was a bad time in his life.
And John, you remember this time period. People who weren't there, didn't live through it, have a hard time accepting that it was real, but it was real for those who were living it.
Yeah, it was real, and when you come to the realization that yes, there are aliens, they are visiting. The government does interact with them. We do have access to their technology. I mean, it's something that it takes you a few months to get used to.
And, there were other things that we didn't cover here, George, like when Bob was in the program, he was told that there were one guy that worked as one of the scientists out at S4 didn't show up for work for a night or two, and they were on the lookout for him, and I guess they sent guys from the OFI to try and find him, and the word was that the Russians were in Las Vegas trying to bribe people for information of what was going on at S4, and at this point in time, Dennis Mariani, who was, again, the security guy who shadowed Bob to and from work, took Bob to the police substation over on St. Louis, down by St. Louis and Eastern Avenue, and registered his gun. Bob had moved here from New Mexico, and he had that Uzi, and he had a .44 Magnum and another small pistol, like a .25 or whatever. And they here's vintage Bob Lazar. Out of the EG&G building, they were going to issue him a gun. And it was just a little .32 or whatever, and the lady told Bob that he had to sign for it, and that if it came up missing, he was going to owe them $500. And Bob argues with them and said, it doesn't even cost that much. Why would I give you $500 if I lost a gun that only cost $250? And he said, why can't I use my own gun? And she said, well, we didn't know you had any. And that's because he lived in New Mexico and you didn't have to register guns back then. And they took him to the police substation. But it's funny that here Bob Lazar is in the most secret program anyone could ever imagine. The Russians are chasing people around. They go to issue him a gun, and he argues about the deposit on it. And but anyway, so Dennis Mariani took him down to the police substation and registered his guns. so he would have legally registered guns to protect himself. And, of course, since then, I think the head guy at that substation was a lieutenant. And, of course, George, we have a mutual acquaintance, TJ, who I've tried to get people to go down. And, you know, that would be important to get those records. Who did Dennis Mariani talk to that they could just walk in there in the evening at nighttime and register a gun at a police substation like that? But, you know, people who tried to get into there were told to mind their own business, and nothing that I'm aware of ever came to fruition from those records.
Of course, the lack of records is the main reason that a lot of people don't believe the story. Stan Friedman comes to mind, the fact that Bob can't prove that he went to school, the places where he claims he got earned degrees. We're going to get into that as soon as we come back from this break. I'm George Knapp. Stay with us for more of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. My guests, Gene Huff and John Lear, talking about the origins of the Area 51 story and Bob Lazar. I remember 20 years ago tonight, you guys were out in the desert. You saw one of these discs being test flown, and Bob was the guy who told you about it. And then two months after that, sometime in May, Bob went on the air at KLAS-TV, blacked out his face. He used the pseudonym Dennis, which was sort of a twisted little shot at his boss, Dennis Mariani, the guy who was in charge of him out there. And life was never the same. He told the basic story in a 4 or 5 minute interview. We started working on a much larger special after that, and things were very different. But I remember in the very first story we ever aired in November of that year, where we revealed Bob's true name and identity, we mentioned that his claims of educational credentials, MIT and Caltech, that we could not verify that. And, you know, subsequently, a lot of people have come forward to say, aha, there's no records that he ever went to those shows. Stan Friedman comes to mind. I give Stan a lot of credit for actually doing the legwork himself and checking it out. But the fact is that we reported that in the very first story where Bob Lazar's name was ever used. It is troubling to me, and I'm sure to you guys, that he can't prove that he went to those schools. I know we all must harbor some doubts about whether he ever did go to those schools, why he would lie about it. I personally have great doubts about it for a simple reason, not because there are no records, but because I can't imagine Bob sitting through other kinds of classes that it would be required to get a degree at any school, English Lit or something like that. I can see him sitting through science classes, electronics classes, but not the other kinds of things he'd have to sit through. Gene, why don't you start it there? You've answered this stuff before. Is it possible that Bob just exaggerated his credentials in order to get a great job?
Well, I don't know that he needed those credentials to get the job. And, I mean, he got the job, at least the one job we know of down at Los Alamos, through Kirk Meyer, which is a headhunter that provides people, you know, for technical and scientific positions at Los Alamos and other national labs. So are they all so stupid that Bob told them, oh, yeah, I've got a couple of master's degrees? They said, oh, okay, well, here, you, we'll hire you as a senior staff physicist, and you go do this job. Certainly, he had clearance. I mean, there's evidence that he had security clearance. So the people that did his security clearance are so stupid. You know what I mean? I don't know that he needed those degrees to get those jobs. If anything, I think he exaggerated it after the fact for ego reasons or whatever. I mean, if he did, it's unfortunate, because I truly believe that he worked on flying discs at S4. And if people are dismissing the story because of his lack of educational credentials, then it was a tragic, tragic mistake. But no one said you needed two master's degrees to have any of the jobs he's held at Los Alamos or at S4.
But wouldn't you say, I mean, the argument being, and John, maybe you can tackle this, gosh, you'd have to have degrees, you'd have to be a really smart guy, and they'd only pick the best scientists. Well, I guess we covered this partly before, but it's got to bother you as well. You know Bob real well. Do you harbor questions about whether he really went to those schools or not?
No, I don't, because when he came over with Gene, he had a resume with him, and there was copies both of his degree from MIT and Caltech. And I asked him when he went there, because this guy, Tom Mahood, did a timeline, and Bob said that Los Alamos had sent him there. Now, I have no doubt about that, but I don't know how the timeline works. I don't know how he could have fitted in.
Well, I'm not saying he didn't go to those schools, but the question is, did he graduate with a master's degree, and what courses could have transferred from one program to another? I mean, that's a complex scenario. I mean, if you have two master's degrees, it doesn't mean you went from your freshman through, you know, 6 years of college for each one, taking all those classes individually. So it's a complex paradigm to say that he's got the two master's degrees. And but, you know, I've discussed this with a lot of people, and the one thing that who've been around Bob, and John, you know this, he is a comprehensive problem solver. I mean, not only does he understand physics, he understands electronics, he understands a lot of things. He's a jack of all trades and master of quite a number. It's not, you know, not master of none. He's a master in electronics. I mean, he's fixed audiophile stereo equipment for me and said, look, I did this for you, but don't tell anybody I can do this because I don't want to be fixing everybody's stereo equipment. And so, you know, I and others have tried to resolve who were they looking for that program at S4. I mean, there's nothing really, they were learning science and from physics that didn't really exist with materials that didn't even exist, you know, commonly on Earth. And so is there any background or other job that would have prepared you for back engineering disks from another planet? And what degree and what importance did they place on what? In other words, your background, your educational credentials, how about whether you could take it? I mean, a lot of people, a devoutly religious person wouldn't want to hear some of the things Bob read in those reports. Again, who could they trust? Who would help them? Who could they trust, or who could they discredit if they couldn't trust them? I think the criteria was a lot more than, you know, you've got these. Look, if they just wanted people with master's degrees, they could have had any number of PhDs in the entire world would have given their right arm to be in that program. So that simply couldn't be the criteria.
Well, you know, for me, the linchpin of his credibility was always Los Alamos. If he worked at Los Alamos lab and sensitive or classified capabilities, that it was entirely plausible that he could be pulled into a program at Area 51 or S4. And I don't think there's any question. In fact, there's no question in my mind that he really was at Los Alamos. Right. I remember the time that he took us there on a weekend and we went in. And he waved
videotape of that tour, and he went any place he wanted, right?
Yeah, he waved at the guard. He took us in. It was like a rabbit going through its own burrow, zipping through these buildings and stuff. He knew his way around, waved at people. We brought a video camera in, as you mentioned, John, and nobody stopped us. We took video of that, and it was pretty clear he knew his way around the place. He was in the phone book, but still, that's not enough. I mean, people, well, that doesn't prove he worked at S4. If he was at S4, it doesn't prove he worked on saucers. It's part of the reason why Bob doesn't really like to talk about this stuff anymore, because there's always going to be another round of questions.
Is this not true of anyone? If someone worked on a terrestrial program, I mean, are they allowed to take home evidence? And if they worked there, did they work on that craft? Does that craft exist? I mean, forget Bob Lazar. Can some man who's working out in Central Nevada on whatever our newest spy plane is right now, is he allowed to prove that he's working on that? And how does he do that?
Let's talk about element 115. This is the magical element that Bob said was used to power these flying saucers. John, give me your take on 115. I know that there's a story that Bob stole some from S4 and brought it home, which is an incorrect assumption on the part of a lot of people. But you got to see this stuff and what it could do in a fairly interesting experiment involving a cloud chamber, right?
Yeah, we took a regular bell jar and some dry ice, and we put the element 115. It was in the little. We didn't steal it. Somebody gave it to him from Los Alamos, and we put out the story that he stole it, so we wouldn't implicate the guy that gave it to us from Los Alamos.
John, wasn't that code name like LA-1000 or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, put the 115 on the dry ice, and then we hung the Coleman lantern mantle, which has thorium in it, and the
the gist of the experiment, the reason we did that was to see the attractive properties of 115. Could it deflect the alpha particles coming being emitted from the thorium emitter? And it did. We videotaped it, and the cloud chamber, you know, the dry ice made the cloud so that we could see the particles and what direction they're going. And of course, they're going straight out at a million miles an hour, and there's nothing that should deflect them. But in fact, the particles, at least one of them, was deflected, and we caught that on videotape. Now the question is, where's the videotape? Now,
John,
I know that Bob has a copy, and you had a copy, and it's like many things in this stuff, they just seem to disappear. All the really hard evidence disappears.
Well, I've got it somewhere. I just don't know where it is in this big pile of stuff.
Was the 115 still inside of that clamshell holder during this experiment?
The little lead thing that Bob made?
Yeah. Well,
he took it out of there.
No, there was a clamshell that it actually came in because it had to be kept under neutron bombardment when it was at rest. I mean, it wasn't just a little thing that Bob made. Remember?
There was a lead container that Bob kept the 115. I don't know about the clamshell thing. Yeah. But
there was a clamshell thing with whatever neutron emitter on the inside of it. I don't know. You know, I'm not a scientist. I don't know what I'm talking about. But I know the 115 had to be kept under neutron bombardment at rest for whatever reason. And there was a casing that it came in. I mean, I don't know that that's the same one you're talking about.
I didn't see the casing.
Okay.
I just saw the little arrowhead shape
that
put on the dry ice. And there was me, Joe Venanetti, and Bob, and I think Jim Taliani was there.
Gene, did you ever see 115 out of the case?
No, not out of the case.
You've heard the stories about. I'll tell you what. We'll hold this till after the break. But I want to go into the stories about 115 because it's now a real element. It wasn't back then. It came out of the sky. An appropriate song for this time period. We'll be back with more of Gene Huff and John Lear, and maybe a call from Bob Lazar. We still have our fingers crossed. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. My name is George Knapp. We're talking with John Lear and Gene Huff about the Area 51 story, the Bob Lazar story, and a key factor in that story is the information about something called Element 115. As I mentioned before that break, I had first been told about it and said, well, it doesn't exist, Bob. And he comes back and says, well, it's theorized that there is an island of stability, that something like this could exist. And of course, now it has been created in a lab, but it only lasted for a couple of seconds. Gene, how do you reconcile Bob's version of what 115 is like, stable, 500 pounds of this stuff, with the reality of what scientists have found?
Well, I'm not that I'm much of a judge. I mean, from a layman's point of view. First of all, remember, 500 pounds isn't a room full. This is an element heavier than lead, so 500 pounds isn't as much as one would surmise. And all I know about it is it wasn't just 115. I believe it was an isotope of 115, and I remember it had to be kept under neutron bombardment at rest because it would be inside this reactor in the disk. It would be they'd actually bombard it with I think a proton, wasn't it, John, that was sent down a tuned tube to actually plug into the nucleus of the 115, which would then
bump it up to 116.
Yeah, make it 116, and then it would fission off some particles, some of which were antimatter, and this antimatter would be reacted with matter, and then the heat from that reaction would be converted to electricity, and this is how the disk was powered. So that's the that's the basic story of 115. And even back then in Van Nostrand's scientific encyclopedia, I think it was the lab for heavy ion research or something like that at Darmstadt, Germany, had done some research, and they were sneaking up on 115 but hadn't created it. And since then, they have created some 115 in a lab, but if you actually examine how they do some of these experiments, I mean, they'll bombard this and bombard that and move particles at a significant percentage of the speed of light and then use this filter or that filter, and so it had to exist and then exist for X amount of seconds or fractions of seconds, and then it decays. So no one's had enough of it, a quantity of it, that they could actually study it and do anything with it, even though they have not only found that it does exist, it's not just a theory. There is an island of stability there. But what they've found is that it decays rapidly. But again, the 115 Bob worked with wasn't just 115, like hydrogen is hydrogen. It was an isotope, and there were special properties involved with it, including how you had to keep it when it wasn't in action.
I remember during that tumultuous period when Bob thought maybe his life was in danger, going to his house one night, and he had the 115 in that lead casing, sort of with a bullseye on it in front of his particle accelerator.
Right.
So the what was he doing there?
Well, I guess the threat was that he would accelerate particles down and plug in a proton I don't know if he would have been able to achieve the speed or the power to do that, but I doubt that somebody at the OFI would know whether he had that capability or not. And I guess it was a threat to cause an antimatter reaction explosion.
Meaning if they were going to take him out, he was going to take them out.
Everybody was going at the same time, right.
John, you buy the story on 115 based on what you saw with that cloud chamber experiment.
Yeah, and the fact is the 115 was stable. There is an island of stability up there, but 116 is not. And what they were doing is bumping the 115 up to 116 by injecting protons into it. And what it would do is when it got to 116, it would immediately decay. And what would happen is during the decay, it would throw off antimatter, which was mixed with matter to create heat, to create power for the ship. And the other was they could access the gravity A wave. And the gravity A wave they used to access and amplify it to pull space towards them to go hundreds of light years, you know, in a very short second. But naturally occurring element with 15 cannot be found anywhere near us. It can only be found in a solar system much larger. As the way Bob explained it, the two main factors which determine the residual matter that remain after the creation of a solar system is the amount of electromagnetic energy and the amount of mass present at the time of the creation of that solar system. A much larger solar system than the one Earth is in would have to have been created to have element 115 occurring as a natural element. So, no, there's no possibility that it's here or it could be mined here, which some people have said, and there's no possibility that they could actually make it. It would take years and years and years of pumping protons and years of electromagnetic energy to make the element 115 that Bob had.
There's a story that of something that happened that hasn't really been told that you guys have not discussed in public, but at one point this piece that Bob had was stolen, wasn't it?
There was three, and two were stolen. Bear me out on this, Gene, and then one we have no comment on.
Gene, who stole it? Who stole the piece?
You know, I just have a vague memory of that. I don't remember who did steal that, John. You know, I remember trying to cut a deal to recover it, and actually Bob Bigelow was actually involved in that, but I don't want to – I don't remember who the guy was that took it or how he got access to it. By the way, with all that stuff John rattled off there with gravity A waves and blah, 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 before you take callers from the public, we know that Earth scientists do not agree that gravity is a wave, and we know that there should be so much waste heat from an antimatter reaction and a little reactor inside of a flying disc that everything would melt, and we understand that. I mean, we're not scientists, and we can't answer those questions as where did all the waste heat go and the arguments about gravity being a wave, just for the record.
Okay. Well, I remember that there was one of the pieces was stolen, and I thought it was like a neighbor or a friend or a hanger-on who was at the house and was interested in all the UFO stuff who
right.
took it, and somehow you got it back. But
I just don't remember his name or how that came about because I remember Bob was real upset that it happened, and we had to try and cut a deal to get it back and go meet with a guy. And we were setting a meeting out at the old Las Vegas Speedway, not the new one, the old one over on northeast part of town there and all of that. And I don't want to start. I don't remember the names and how it happened. So,
what happened to the piece? I mean, you know what happened to it. Can you say how much can you say?
Well, you know, it was. You know, he buried it at a place where
where it'd be hard for anybody to get.
Well, it would be hard to get, but it would be secure at that location for a long time. It would be obvious if its containment was ever jeopardized.
So basically, you know, it's known where that piece is.
Yeah.
Speaking of elements,
by the way, it's not like I could drive there and go pick it up,
right.
or I would.
Right. Speaking of strange elements, the element polonium surfaces much later in the Bob Lazar story. Of course, after this UFO stuff, Bob tries to leave all of it behind, doesn't want to talk about it anymore, starts up a scientific supply business online, United Nuclear, and sells all kinds of weird stuff to schools and labs. And one of the things that he sold was something called polonium. And it surfaced in a major news story a year or so ago, 2 years ago, when a Russian spy was killed, presumably through the use of polonium. And news organizations start looking around to see where could somebody get polonium and whose name comes up.
Bob Lazar, ladies and gentlemen.
Hey, how'd that work out?
Well, you know, he always had things like that around. I remember him talking about polonium and, in fact, he had ordered some polonium and beryllium from a scientific supply place a long time ago. And a guy from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission came by Bob's house and wanted to know why he wanted polonium and beryllium, because those are actuators, like I know what I'm talking about here. They're actuators in the nuclear explosion in an atomic bomb. Polonium and beryllium are actuators of some sort. So when he ordered some and tried to buy some back then, the NRC sent a guy by his house who really knew what he was talking about, and Bob couldn't talk his way out of it because the guy said, well, for what you need, you can use these other things. You don't need polonium and beryllium, because Bob had a pseudo-purpose other than whatever he wanted it for. And so then when he opened up his own scientific supply place, he found a supplier of it, but we're talking about, you know, it's just so they can use it to detect it with Geiger counters. I mean, you could fit the amount he's selling would fit on the head of a pin, so it's not a quantity of it.
Let's talk about broad strokes here. We've got a couple of minutes left before we open up the phone lines. Did you, you, John, and then you, Gene, did you have any idea at the time that this was going to become this big? I mean, the Area 51 story is sort of a phenomenon. It's known all over the world. Books and movies and things of that sort, and T-shirts and ashtrays and trinkets and posters. And, it's been featured on all kinds of TV shows and in all kinds of articles in the UFO field and beyond. Did you have any idea how big it would get back then?
Well, first of all, you said a couple months after he did the thing in Silhouette. I think it was the week after, because we did that on the record, and you said the phone was ringing off the hook, and it was the next day that you had Bob do the Silhouette interview, and then the day after that you came up here with Bob Stoldow and interviewed Bob to find out what his credibility was. But the answer to what I thought, I honestly believe that after he did that interview in Silhouette, that the story would break worldwide and everybody would know that we had flying saucers and aliens were visiting us and everything. I honestly believe that.
I did too, George. I thought we were seeing a change in the world. In fact, I would tell Bob, before it ever went public, I'd say, boy, you know, this would make a great screenplay. And, in fact, right after he got caught, I was going to put material together to write a book, and he knew I had done some screenwriting in the past and gone to screenwriting lectures and courses and things like that. And he said, don't write a book. Why don't you write a screenplay? And like you said, I wrote the screenplay. And, of course, that movie's almost been made 4 or 5 times now, but always falls through for through the millions of normal Hollywood reasons. And but, yes, I did think this. In fact, I was talking to John today when Bob was in the program, and when he started telling us some things, and when he started hinting around about taking us out to see the disc test, he'd tell me about being with his partner, and I'd say, well, what's his name? And he goes, I don't know. And I'd say, well, don't they have those name tags on just like you have that you pick up when you go to work? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, if I were you, I'd start noticing some people's names just in case things go bad. And because Bob's got a bad memory anyway. And he would work there and be so absorbed in what he was working on. You know, he'd see a number of people with name badges on and wouldn't even notice what their names were. And so, yeah, I convinced him to start looking at people's names because I did think this would be a worldwide story, and it would certainly be helpful if you could locate any of these other people to corroborate what Bob was saying.
I guess you weren't thinking about the marketing potential immediately. I mean, you thought about a screenplay, but good gosh, this thing has become a cottage industry. It's gone in so many different directions and all over the world.
In fact, John and I just said today that there's nobody on this planet that has made less money from ufology than me and John Leary. Everybody in the world has sold videos and books and everything in the world. We haven't made a cent.
And you were there in the beginning.
Right, right.
Well, how has it changed your lives? You know, John, you pretty much believe that this stuff was possible, and so there was no fundamental shift in your belief system, but it's had to have had an effect on your life personally, economically.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, at that time I was working for American Transair, and, of course, everybody or, you know, most of the people know that in July of 89, which is a month or two or a couple months after this happened, they called me in and they said, John, you don't really believe this stuff, do you? I said, well, as a matter of fact, I do. And they said, well, you know, we can't have a captain flying an L-1011 with passengers who believes in flying saucers. And that was it for me. They fired me. And it was probably a good thing that happened because I went to work for the cargo airlines there in Detroit and had a lot of fun, met a great bunch of guys, and really had a career kind of change. Instead of flying, you know, passengers and have to worry about them, I was flying cargo boxes. And, you know, it's all night flying, and it was just worked out great for me because I'd rather fly at night and sleep all day long.
And, Gene, for you, you mentioned that this isn't the kind of thing that you cashed in on any way, but it has had to have a profound effect on how you see the world around you, hasn't it?
It did. I actually started reading everything I get my hands on. You know, again, with me, it's the basic of questions of man. Yes, gravity propulsion and antimatter reactors, and that's interesting to a degree, but, you know, who are we, where do we come from, where are we going to, life after death, God, you know, the basic questions of man are what I'm interested in. And you know, I think if anything, you know, with knowledge comes unhappiness, and knowing where we stand on the interstellar food chain and not necessarily believing anymore that, you know what I mean? Knowing where you stand on the interstellar food chain, you know, I'm pretty much back down with, I was born and raised a Christian and went to a Lutheran grade school, and, you know, I'm all the way down to life as a series of chemical reactions, and of course, the one thing that I think I gained out of it is that I truly believe, I don't believe in, you know, creation, you know, as opposed to evolution. I don't believe in straight line evolution either. I believe that, and this has gotten around a long way since I grappled with this in the late 80s, but I believe that man is a product of externally corrected evolution, which is part of the things Bob has read in those reports out there. In other words, that man's straight line evolution was intervened by a non-deity catalyst. And so, I don't think that when the dinosaurs were here, we were some little rodent hiding in the bushes and we ended up being the human beings we are. I think our evolution has been intervened by at least, you know, who knows how many times, but certainly by someone from elsewhere. And I think ufology, I think UFOs and aliens, which may look like us or may not look like us, are the basis for many of the God, Lord, and angel stories from the Old Testament. And if you read Zechariah Sitchin's Earth Chronicles and look at the Sumerian writings and all of that information, I think you start to get a handle on how all of the religions and things that really govern this planet and in some instances ruin this planet, where they came from and how things got to be the way they are. So I guess that's a plus. I don't know.
John, anything to elaborate on that?
Well, I got a little bit farther than that. You know, I really believe that the entire solar system is inhabited. All the planets are inhabited, including the Moon, Venus, Jupiter. They say that, you know, four of the planets are gas giants. The only gas giant we have in this solar system is NASA and his son, Jim Oberg. But
NASA's, you know, the only gas giant?
What's that?
Did you say NASA is the only gas giant?
Yeah, NASA would be the only gas giant.
Fellas, it's been interesting. We've still got some time to go. We're going to be opening up the phone lines with our listener questions, and I've got a few more of my own, and we might still hear from Bob. I don't know. Stick around, everyone, for more Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. Welcome back, everyone. My guests, John Lear, Gene Huff, talking about the origins of the Bob Lazar story, Area 51, flying saucers, all of that. I'm going to go to the phone lines in just a second. I do want to touch on one other thing. Gene, you were talking about how this has profoundly affected your view of life and universe and where we came from. There was something else that Bob Lazar said he read in some of the documents out at Groom Lake. That is very disturbing. We didn't touch on it before, but it was tough to get out of him, as I recall. And I'm talking about this reference to a harvesting of souls. Do you remember what that was about?
I don't think Bob read anything about a harvesting of souls. He read that man was the product of externally corrected evolution and that man as a species had been genetically altered 65 times. And, of course, we extrapolated that out and said, now how do you genetically alter a species? Certainly breeding wouldn't do it, especially historically when transportation and communication weren't what they are now. So we actually concluded that airborne and waterborne viruses, especially retroviruses, just like AIDS is a retrovirus that goes in and destroys your immune system, if an advanced intelligence could do genetic alterations and actually send airborne and waterborne retroviruses out to retrofit anything that has that water and air as a common denominator, could then be genetically altered. John, do you recall Bob reading? I mean, I know there's been a lot of info on the harvesting of souls, but did you recall Bob reading that at S4? I don't.
No, what he read was that the aliens referred to us as containers.
Right.
And I was trying to get him to say, well, I think what we contain is souls. He says, no, it didn't say that. He said it could be,
there's the right genetic information like to be altered or whatever.
Just let me say here that since Bob probably isn't going to call in, I'd like to tell our listening audience what I think that he would have said if he'd come on.
Okay.
He would have said, I don't know, I don't remember, I don't care, I don't recall. And any question that starts with, well, John Lear says, Bob would have said, everybody knows John Lear is a nutball.
John Lear is crazy. But, yeah, on that note, I mean, we all know each other here in Las Vegas, and we have talked about many things that I don't know if they're able to be understood out of context to someone who doesn't know anything about the subject and happens to be listening. So we may have to come back another time and answer a lot more questions because the things we've said beg more questions. And I'd also like to say that Bob really was regretful that he was supposed to try and call in, but he was in transit over a 2,000-mile trip hauling 3 horses and 3 dogs and 3 cats and furniture in a 4-vehicle caravan. And it's not like this was, some ploy to get people to listen that Bob Lazar might call in. I'm certain we can get him to join us another night when he's not in the middle of a cross-country move.
Oh, well put then. We're going to go to the phones, our international line, Greg in Ontario. Hi, Greg. How you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Okay. What's on your mind?
First off, I just wanted to congratulate your guests on having the spine to express these kind of views, especially for people with a professional background like a pilot. Some people tend not to take these kind of things seriously. What I wanted to ask, though, was if you gentlemen believe that faster-than-light travel is possible something along the lines of how it's depicted in Star Trek, for example.
No doubt about it.
How is it depicted in Star Trek?
Well, in Star Trek, it's depicted as just an engineering exercise, and we don't have the engineering expertise yet.
Well, yeah, I'd say we do believe that that's what Bob Lazar learned, is that distorting space and time rather than flying at a significant percentage of the speed of the light in a straight line in a linear mode, they actually distort the space and time that between you and your destination. Similar, I guess, to creating an artificial wormhole. Would that be a good radio demonstration? I don't know. But yes, that you can distort space and time, and ultimately you did travel faster than the speed of light, although you never flew faster than the speed of light in a straight line.
John, you want to tackle that as well? Yeah, it does. John, you want to tackle that as well?
Well, basically, we think as outer space is as a nothing, that it's just a cold thing, nothing's there. Actually, 1 cubic meter of space contains 1 hydrogen atom. It's actually a fabric. You could take this and push it and pull it and distort it. What they do with the gravity amplifiers is to pull that space towards them, wrap it around the craft, turn the gravity generator off, and then you're instantaneously hundreds and thousands of miles away from where you pulled that space. You unite or coalesce or join with that particular piece of space. And what they can do is recycle that generator every 12 milliseconds. So if you can travel hundreds of thousands of miles every 12 milliseconds, and you multiply that by how many milliseconds are in, how many 12 milliseconds are in a second, then times a minute, then times a day and a year, you can go a pretty long distance in a pretty short time.
By the way, Earth scientists know that gravity distorts space and time. That's how the old experiment they did where you could see stars behind the sun during an eclipse. That's a famous experiment. So we know that gravity distorts space and time. What we don't know is how you can generate an artificial gravitational field. And this is the info that the aliens brought, how you can, when you can do that, you can distort space and time into a much greater degree than that, caused by a star or a planet.
Greg, thanks for that call. We need to take a break right now. We'll come back with more of your calls for John Lear and Gene Huff right after this. Stay with us. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM, talking with Gene Huff and John Lear about Area 51, Bob Lazar, flying saucers. You know the story. We're going to go to the phone lines east of the Rockies, Davis in Kentucky. Good morning, Davis.
Good morning, gentlemen, and bless you all. I was thinking back. It's been years ago, but Art had, I thought, Bob on, and they were talking about the 118 element, and somebody called in and said that there was a Microsoft encyclopedia that you can buy called Encarta or something like that, that in the physics section, 1976 or something, there was an article in there about that. And apparently it had been discovered on a meteorite that came in, naturally. And some other elements had been discovered. I don't have the article. I don't have that kind of money to buy that. But anyway, this guy described that they discovered up through 124 naturally on Earth, someplace in Africa, through spectral, technology. I don't know. Leave it out there with you.
I haven't heard that, and I would think that would be some of the biggest news in the scientific community. I've never heard a whisper of it. Have you, John or George?
No, that's impossible, not on Earth. It has to be a solar system.
Well, he said it came in on a meteorite. So.
Well, that's interesting. Maybe we'll have to look for that that article and see what the origin of the story is.
But I'd appreciate to be stable and have a handful of it in a meteorite, I have my doubts that that's probably accurate, but maybe there's a piece of truth there, and it's just a little mixed up.
Thanks, Davis. Appreciate it. West of the Rockies, Dale from here in Las Vegas. Hi, Dale.
Hi. I was just wondering, I've read the stories about the flying saucer that Bob Lazar observed, and I'm wondering, where are they now, and if the government has them, why wouldn't they use them? Because I can imagine all kinds of good uses for them. Where do you think they are?
John, do you think they're at the new Area 51 you were talking about?
I think they're probably at the new Area 51. I don't think they'd use them. They're very careful with, you know, what they do with them. I don't think that we use them for, like, going anywhere or transporting. I think they're still studying them.
And if they can glean any technology from it, they're going to use it on a craft or in any capacity that would look normal to any, you know, Earthling. If they don't fly the craft themselves, if they learn something from the craft that can be used in another craft of a more acceptable shape so you could operate it in broad daylight without being under suspicion, that is probably what they do.
Who knows? They might be using them for something they haven't told us about. And I suppose
right.
If you used them, as a, for example, in a war, in a theater of war.
Well, the technology that Bob worked on with those flying saucers is certainly far advanced. We have our own anti-grav technology, which we developed between 1953 and 1955. My father was a major contractor on that development and through his company, Lear Incorporated. So, you know, we had anti-grav, a form of it, in 1955. That's why you never see anything in the news on how we're progressing on anti-grav. We already have it, but it's a secret.
I guess the danger would be if you use it, like, in a war and somebody gets it shot down, then you got some explaining to do. Thanks, Dale. Thanks for the call. First-time caller, Robert, in Arizona. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Mr. Knapp and your guest, good evening to you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
In 2004, when Bob Lazar was on Coast to Coast Radio with Art Bell, the night he talked about Element 115, he mentioned at the last of the hour of the interview, and before they went on the news break, and nobody ever did a follow-up on this, but he said that when Element 115 was, before it was fired up in the reactor, he said that a gas was introduced into the reactor. In the next hour when calls were taken, nobody ever asked what that gas was.
Now, the gas was just the matter that the antimatter interacts with. It's put in a tuned tube. The antimatter, like I know this, I'm just saying this is as Bob has told me in the past. After the 115 is bombarded, this is all a closed system. The 115 is bombarded, turns to 116. It decays, releases antimatter. The antimatter travels down a tuned tube, meaning, I guess, what's a tuned tube? Whatever forces, magnetism, electromagnetic, so it doesn't explode because the tube itself is made out of matter, okay? So it travels down a tuned tube, and it interacts, the matter that it interacts with to cause the antimatter matter explosion from which the heat is turned to electricity, that matter is gas. That's what the gas is. So I don't think it probably, yeah, I don't know what gas that was. It could be hydrogen. It could be anything. It's just, that's the matter target that the antimatter explodes with.
Does that answer your question, Robert? Robert's gone. We're going to move on. Our wild card line, Roland in Boise, Idaho. How you doing, Roland? Hello, Roland. Are you there?
I'm here, George.
What's on your mind?
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'm proud to say that I've read transcripts of all your interviews with Bob Lazar over the years, and so I've kind of started this back in the late 70s. And I'm calling to defend his position, Lazar's position, that he's a tech head guy, not a politician. So he knows his tech. One of the things that I wanted to bring up was that if there's standalone energy production, like Bob indicates with the technology, what would that do to the world of economics today? When you look at ExxonMobil, who's produced record profits more than any other company in any other industry ever over the past, you know, year or so, these people would not want a standalone energy producer that can power cars, electric for homes and factories. They've got a good thing going, and they're not going to allow the status quo to be disrupted. So that's why I'm saying that when you see some of the movies where, you know, people's identities are all messed up and credit cards are deleted and things like that, These people have the power to do that, and I think that's exactly what they've done to Bob Lazar. But would either John or
Gene?
Mr. Huff care to expound on how this standalone energy might affect our world of economics today?
John, you want to tackle that one?
Yeah, of course. Everything would collapse if we were able to use all that. It's the same thing with oil. Oil is abiogenic, which means it's self-produced. It's not made of dead dinosaurs. There's plenty of oil all over the place. We have the greatest reserves of oil under the United States. It's just they want us to think that that we've peaked oil and that we're running out and that we've got to be careful. That's all baloney. We've got all the oil that we need.
George, I would just say I think this gentleman's right. I mean, the essence of that is where there are people, there are problems. There's greed and other concerns. And so, yes, something fantastic that could be a wonder for all of us to grasp and enjoy in our lives could very well be kept from us because of greed, as tragic as that is. So I think he's absolutely right.
Well, if it's real, if the technology exists and we've got it, that might be a very plausible reason for the cover-up, is just to not to upset the economic apple cart. Thanks for the call, Roland. Wildcard 2 line, Bill in Texas. Hi, Bill.
Hey, George, how are you doing?
Okay.
Wonderful show tonight.
Thanks.
Yeah, I have a comment and a question for your guest. Earlier I was listening to, several years ago, I guess, and they were talking about when Jackie Gleason went to Homestead Air Force Base with President Nixon at the time to view dead alien bodies.
That's the story.
And anyway, just as a curiosity feature, I was stationed there about that time. Of course, I didn't see any dead alien bodies, but there were some. There was one story of the southern Miami area and Homestead Air Force Base being hovered over by UFOs two particular nights, and they sent aircraft up to investigate. And I don't know what became of that, but anyway, I did get on Google and Googled that and checked that, because I was unaware of Jackie Gleason going down there to check that out. But I found that very interesting. And my question is, what do your guests feel as to 2012? What do you think, what do they think might happen, if anything at all? And I'll hang up and listen to the responses. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Let me take that. It's sheer baloney. There is no Planet X. There is no Nibiru. And if there is, it's not going to cause any problem. Whoever is running the show here wants to keep us in a state of anxiety and worry and, the world's going to end, but all that's baloney.
By the way, if
come
you read,
and go just like every other day that's been.
By the way, if you read, if you're referring to Nibiru and the Anunnaki from Zechariah Sitchin, if you read Zechariah Sitchin's new last book of that Earth Chronicles series, End of Days, I got some bad news for people like me who were hoping that it would be close enough. First of all, if the gods of Eden, they don't need to wait for Nibiru to get back here. They could fly here if they just wanted to come here. So they don't need to wait if that planet exists in a comet, 3,600-year orbit around our sun. Though the Anunnaki do not need to wait until it gets close so they could visit the Earth. Certainly, if they had that type of technology thousands of years ago, they certainly have it now. And secondly, the way Sitchin has that orbit figured is it's not going to be in the same proximity to the Earth as it was, 2,000 years ago till the year 2900. So in 2012, if you're basing that on the Zechariah Sitchin calendar, absolutely nothing is going to happen.
You know, I remember vaguely something about a Project Looking Glass that Bob had talked about, and read something about it in these documents, some sort of a machine that where you could peek
see
into
back
the future.
In time.
See back in time? Could you see forward?
That one was just about seeing back in time. There were other projects going on. He was in Project Galileo. That was the project, or what it was called then, with the back engineering of the disk. There was another one with a beam weapon, I think with a gravity lens, if I remember right, called Project Sidekick. And then the other one was Project Looking Glass, which was a method of seeing back in time. And again, we think of seeing back in time as going back and seeing who shot JFK.
Right.
But seeing back in time for scientists, just being able to see back 2 or 3 seconds could make a big difference. So.
All right. Stay with us. More of your questions for Gene Huff and John Lear on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. Stick around, everyone. Welcome back. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. We are in the home stretch with our guests, Gene Huff and John Lear. We'll get as many of your questions in as we can. We're going to Allentown, Pennsylvania, and Ed is standing by on our wild card line. Hi, Ed.
Hi there, George. Good morning.
Good morning to you. What's on your mind?
First of all, I would like to thank you, the three of you, for all the work you've done. And in this topic, you brought it to reality, to this earth, and you saved Bob Lazar's life, practically. And I think that should be, the world should be indebted to you, all three of you, in that sense. You a lot for it also, George. A line of levity, 20 years ago, I was watching Joan Rivers on a Tonight Show episode, and she made a UFO joke that I thought was hysterically funny, and I want to share it.
Okay.
She said, "You'll never see a UFO land on the Jewish front lawn." And the audience laughed, and she said, "Because they threw it over. Turn it over to see who manufactured it." Anyway, I have a question. It's a compound. Is element 115, like, manufactured by any corporation? Is it regulated by the government? And I have another question also after that, if I may.
Okay. Gene?
I'm ready.
His question is element 115 manufactured by the government or anybody else? I think the answer probably is, it's made and they tried to synthesize some of it in a lab.
Yeah, they're synthesizing it. It happens in labs, in government laboratories in Europe and the United States. They get their funding from governments. I'm not aware of any private endeavors, but they wouldn't necessarily call me and tell me they were working on it. So I don't know if it's done privately or not. I don't think anyone's created enough of it to be able to even study it, so I really don't have an answer.
Yeah, I agree. It cannot be made. It's naturally occurring element, and it can only occur in large solar systems.
Gene, wasn't there a time when one of these labs, these heavy ion labs that you referenced earlier, they were contacting Bob for information about 115, even though, he's a non-scientist and a phony and all that stuff in the view of a lot of people?
Yeah, some scientists from Germany, they had about 100-page formula, literally 100 pages of a physics formula all about 115, and it was gibberish to me. I was lost. I joked, I told Bob, if I were him, I'd put times zero equals zero at the end of it. That's how complex it was.
There are
people. There are people who firmly believe there's an island of stability, and certainly with isotopes that there will be heavy stable elements do occur elsewhere. It's just like John said before, the amount of energy, the cost to synthesize it would exhaust the planet. I mean, it'll never be synthesized in any quantity.
What was the second question? Is that caller still there? Guess not. West of the Rockies, Jeff in California. Hi, Jeff.
Calling from Albion, California, and listening on KKOH 780 AM, home of Ross Mitchell out of Reno, Nevada. And, John, I'm curious as to how you came up with the infamous John Lear test and how much of that Bob Lazar was attributable to that. And also, what was your opinion of Art Bell's response to that in regards to whether he would reveal that as a public official on the veracity of those issues brought up in that John Lear test?
Well, actually, it's just something I wrote up based on information I had. What I'm going to have to do is write Disclosure Test 2.0 to bring it up to date with things I have learned since then.
What's the John Lear test, John? I don't even know.
That was a disclosure test that I gave to Art Bell several years ago, and it's all over the net. It's based on what I thought was going on, and a lot of it was true, but a lot of it was not. And I've got to write the disclosure 2.0, which I haven't gotten around to yet.
All right. Well, look forward to reading that then. Thanks for the call. We're going to go to our first-time caller line, Thomas in Michigan. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, gentlemen. Gene, you were asking about connection with God. If you took a look at the book of Psalms and realized that it's a timeline that has been describing events at a rate of a chapter per year for the last 100 years, I think you'd catch on. Take a look at Psalm 74, where it talks about Leviathan. It was in that year that we raised the Russian K-129 diesel submarine, which sank in 68. That thing is the Leviathan. And you take a look at Psalm 68, the chariots of God. He's talking about vehicles coming back here to basically stop a war. Those were the year we sank that submarine. We had missile disruptions throughout the entire United States as Russia because they were getting too close.
Well, if that makes sense to you and you're at peace with it, then you're a lucky man.
Okay, well, I think it would be very helpful because, the Psalms work as a timeline. They explain everything that's going on. We have 9/11 in there. We have the 91 Gulf War in there, World War II, Holocaust, the atomic bomb development in 1945. All the things that you're talking about are being explained to you right out of there.
I don't think Gene wants to argue with you. The point being that you're good with it, and he sees things differently. But I thank you for the call anyway, Thomas. Thank you. Wild card line, William in Florida. Hi, William.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
My question to all of you, I don't know if it would have come better at the beginning of the show, or maybe it's more appropriate at the end. For years now, as I've observed ufology and the fascination with flying saucers, I always go back to what's referred to as the original flying saucer sighting by Mr. Kenneth Arnold around Mount Rainier, Washington, June 24th, 1947. Mr. Arnold made a comment saying that described a boomerang-shaped object that skipped like a saucer but did not look like a saucer. Flying saucers, from what I've seen, have never been seen prior to him saying flying saucers. And I know several of the gentlemen there are pilots, as am I, and you know that a flying saucer, per se, is a aerodynamically inferior design. If it was a good design and it would work aerodynamically, the space shuttle would probably be a flying saucer. I'm very interested in your response to that, and in your opinion, is all this flying saucer stuff, for lack of a better term, could it be based on misinformation from the very beginning, from 1947?
Well, you're saying isn't true. There are... If you you take a look in videos and books and printed information about things, objects in the sky in antiquity, you know, in centuries past, there are saucer shaped objects in that people have seen in the sky long before Kenneth Arnold.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So what the paradigm you're setting up is not correct.
The other part of it is aerodynamics even a factor in building a saucer?
No, they're not flying through the wind with a winged aircraft. I mean, I don't want to start a moon argument with John, but the moon rovers didn't look like a 747 either. You know what I mean? They weren't flying in air in our atmosphere. So,
thanks, William. Appreciate the call. Mike in Indiana, also on a wild card line. Good morning, Mike.
Morning, guys. And just to add to that previous caller with the disc shape, take a look at a Frisbee. They're round.
Good point.
I got a question for you guys. I don't know if you're going to have an answer for it or not, but you probably will. Who invented nanotechnology?
Don't know.
I don't know specifically. You mean with all the nanowires and everything that exists nowadays?
Talking about nanotechnology.
Yeah, it's one of the most important technologies to come forward in this time, and as we go on through the next years, it'll become more and more important. It's a very interesting technology.
But it's universally handled by Earth scientists. I mean, is the implication that it came from alien technology? Is that what you're curious about?
Yeah, I mean, is it back engineered technology?
I don't know.
I don't remember Bob ever mentioning something about that.
No.
Sorry, we couldn't answer your question there.
See if you could run it across to Bob next time you talk to him and ask him, see if he knows.
All righty.
Give it a go. Thanks, Mike. We're going to go to Mark in Dallas, Texas. Hi, Mark.
Hi, George. How are you?
Okay, what's on your mind?
Yes, I was going to ask one of your, or either one of your guests there. There was a guy that I seen a talk show on, either on the internet, Google, or YouTube or something, that he claimed that he was taking out to Area 51. He was a rocket scientist. And that when he was taken out to Area 51, he was taken below the ground and all that stuff. And he said he witnessed this alien-type engine that they supposedly got off of a alien ship or something. And he said that it wasn't a metallic type of metal. He said it was actually like it was a living type of metal.
A biological?
Biological. He was one of the real famous rocket scientists. He did it all his life since he was like a little kid and everything. And because he invented this fuel or whatever, the guys from the government or Area 51 or something said, hey, you know, come on out here. We got something we want to show you because we can't figure out how it works. Could you please explain to us how this thing works? And he said when he seen it, he was just, you know, absolutely amazed about it. And I was wondering, did Bob know anything about this, or one of your guests there, or whatever happened to that story, or whatever?
No, I had trouble with that story. You know, supposedly he was taken out to Area 51 when he was 16 years old and told him how to do this and do that. And Wernher von Braun was a personal friend of his. And the only problem I have with that story is he describes going into Groom Lake in 1972, and he saw the two long runways there. Well,
they weren't
built by then, you know, and the real long one that he describes wasn't built until the 90s. So it's a very interesting story, but I don't believe it.
A lot of people, Mark, have come forward in the years since Bob Lazar first went public with his story, and they've borrowed little bits and pieces. You guys, you've seen the march of different versions of the story, haven't you? John and Gene?
What's that?
You've seen the march of these other pseudo Bob Lazar types who've come forward with bits and pieces.
Well, Bob saw things bench tested also. I mean, they froze a flame. They stage shifted it out of time and made a flame stand still. And of course, the question is, what happened to the photons? I know there are scientific questions, but so Bob saw things bench tested. Barry, the guy that indoctrinated him, threw a golf ball off of the gravity A field around an antimatter reactor and bounced off and knocked one of the ceiling tiles out of the drop ceiling in the room that they were in. So stories like that get passed down the line also and distorted, augmented, and then people wonder where the actual story came from. So
thanks for that call, Mark. I appreciate it. East of the Rockies, John in Atlanta. You there, John?
Yes, George. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ingo Swan on Coast one night, he was describing we as human beings, as being extraordinary sensing systems. Sensing potential and capabilities are not confined to this time-space reality. Now, after my study of remote viewing, which I've read everything I can get my hands on and other related topics, you know, I'm really interested in the big questions surrounding this whole issue, alien phenomena, what they know about us and who we are.
Yeah, that's my interest also. That's why the things like when Bob read that, and if it's true, I mean, I don't know how to authenticate it, that man is the product of externally corrected evolution and that man as a species has been genetically altered 65 times. That makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know if it makes sense to other people because I could never believe just straight line evolution all the way if you look at what was happening in the dinosaurs and how they apparently died out and we made it through or we came from the sea or whatever and end up being what we are, especially the accelerated evolution that we've gone through. Look at what has happened in the last 100 to 150 years as compared to the prior, you know, millennia. It just seems like we're in a period of accelerated evolution, and I can buy that we were that acceleration came from external alterations, and people might even want to say God did those alterations. That's fine with me, but that makes sense. That's my interest also. That's what I call the basic questions of man. Who are we? Where did we come from? God, life after death. Those are the things that preoccupy a lot of us.
And John Lear, I remember you talking about this very same thing in one of the first interviews we had more than 20 years ago, where you talked about sudden explosion in human capabilities, fire the wheel all at the same time, right?
Yeah, and for those that don't know, Ingo Swann is the grandfather of remote viewing, and his famous book, Penetration, I don't think you can get a copy now for less than $400, but if you can get a hold of a copy, it's extremely interesting.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. Thank you for the call, John. West of the Rockies, Dayton in Reno, Nevada. Hi, Dayton.
Hi. Yeah, John, we shot trap together out in Harold's Club. It's gone now. We both had Krieghoffs, as I remember. But I wondered, you used to know your parents quite well after you moved away, and he had a Mercedes 300 SL Gullwing. Did you happen to get that?
So the Mercedes?
Yeah, the Gullwing. They're real rare.
I didn't hear what he said, George.
He wants to know if you got that from the family fortune.
Your parents had a Gullwing. That was sold in the estate. I forget who got that Mercedes. Oh, I'll tell you who got that Mercedes. You mean the Gullwing?
Yeah.
My daughter got that.
Oh.
She's got it now?
Yeah.
Wow, we should take that out for a spin one of these days.
Yeah, let's do it.
Dayton, thanks for the call. We're going to go to our first-time caller line, Brian in Sacramento. How you doing, Brian?
Hi, I'm doing good. I had a couple questions. I was wondering if you guys think the current UFO sightings are alien or, like, military. You know, like, people have been seeing a lot pretty recently.
Maybe both.
I think half and half. I think the Phoenix ones were alien. The one in Chicago was alien. And a lot of the others are the military fooling around.
That's the problem with all of the modern-day prototype aircraft, all the especially secret ones that the typical layman isn't familiar with, is distinguishing between, you know, alien technology and things that are going on Earth that the average person doesn't know about. That's why I really respect the sightings in antiquity, the things that happened in the skies that people recorded and saw and drew paintings of before photography, because there was nothing else in the sky other than a bird that could be mistaken for. And even the sightings from the 40s and 50s and 60s are important, because now that we can go mock whatever, it becomes more and more difficult present day to distinguish between alien technology and just advanced Earth technology.
And a heck of a lot of the craft, the advanced craft that they're working on, prototypes, sure as heck look like flying saucers.
Look pretty alien, yeah.
Yep. Thanks for the call, Brian. Try to get one more call in on our wildcard line. Mayday in Tucson, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going? Good morning, guys. First time calling as well. My question, I know you guys are short in time, I'll just say it, you guys can cut me off from there, but it's about reverse engineering and if fiber optics was a part of that at all.
Sounds like a Corso question, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a Corso question. Did Bob ever mention anything like that?
No, not to my knowledge.
John, the reverse engineering process, people have a hard time getting their head around that, but that's the story, the essence of the story of what Bob had to say from the beginning, is that they were taking these things apart to figure out how they work. Do you think we're how much further do you think we are down the line in understanding how they work?
50 years. The technology is about 50 years of where everybody thinks it is.
Meaning we're 50 years further down the road than the military.
Generally think where we are, yeah.
We've got a minute or so left for each of you. No, we don't. There's the music.
Nope.
We've got about 50 seconds. Gene, thank you for staying up with us. John, it's always a pleasure.
Let's do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Maybe we can get Bob here. We're sorry that Bob Lazar was not able to call in. We had hoped that he would join us here, but the time will come. This whole year is filled with different kinds of anniversaries of things that happened back there in 1989. It was a time that changed all of our lives, and I'm sure we're going to continue to talk about it. Thanks to my guests and the staff there at Coast to Coast. I'll see you next time, everyone. Have a good one.